Okay. Now I guess we get to the big show. Before we start, Mr. Stagg, want to explain how this is going to operate, folks. So staff is going to give a presentation here, lay out the basics of the project. The applicant's going to get a time to flesh out their points of view on this. The commission will have some questions, I'm sure. And then I will open it up for testimony here from anybody in the audience who wishes to testify. I'm not going to put anybody on a timer. We're not going to confine this. I want the board to hear what you have to say. I want the board to understand all the issues as you see them. That said, brevity is important. How many people, by a show of hands, would like to testify here today? Okay, look around the room. We got 25 or 30 people. If you confine your comments to 5 minutes, we'll be here until 1 o'clock this afternoon or two. So if you have an organization, pick a designated spokesperson, if you would, that would be helpful. I'm going to urge people to state on the points at hand. At some point, we're going to reach a point here where I'm going to be past urging that. I'm going to be insisting upon that. And at some point, I'm going to say, is there anything that we haven't heard that somebody wants to testify about? And at that point, that's the key. We're going to wrap this up and make a decision. So that's the ground rules for today. I want an open and civil discussion here. These are major issues. Everybody has a valid point, I presume. We want to hear it. Mr. Stagg, let's start the ball rolling.
Good morning, commissioners.
Good morning.
I guarantee you this one will take a little longer than the last. So this is a project for Virginia Electric and Power Company requesting authorization to cross state-owned Sebaquis bottom lands as part of a 27.75-mile overhead transmission line that's been sort of renamed colloquially as the Surrey Skips Creek Wheelton Substation Project. It will span the James River from Surrey County over to James City County, and then run up the peninsula of Newport News. It does include crossings of Wood Creek in James City County and Skips Creek, which is the line is between James City County and Newport News and Skips Creek, as well as the Lee Hall and Hardwood Mills reservoirs. They do have a drainage area that makes the crossings of the old stream bed of those jurisdictional as non-tidal water bodies. The project is protested by a number of organizations and residents. So this is a overview of the entire project with some impact tables, just to give you a scope of how far the project goes. This is a little better representation to orient you as to where the project actually is. Again, it runs from the Surrey Nuclear Power Plant, which is shown here on the left, out into the river to the north, across the river to James City County, and then up the peninsula and then back down towards Newport News. You can see the river crossing of the James, and then Woods Creek and Skips Creek, and then the reservoirs are in this area down here. We received this application on March 20th of 2013. The stated purpose for the application is to increase service in the Hampton Roads load area, as Dominion calls it. The application stated that power flow studies show that their transmission line facilities will not meet the North American Electric Reliability Corporation standards due to the planned shutdown of two coal-fired units located in Yorktown. Those units 1 and 2 were originally scheduled to be shut down by 2015. However, that was delayed. They did get an extension, and they did not close down until April of this year. The application was subjected to our normal public interest review. Due to the complex nature of the application and the requirement for numerous approvals for portions of the project, a number of minor revisions were made to the project early on as the agencies reviewed the application's potential impact to any of their specific programs. The project now includes the following submerged land impacts. There'll be 17 towers and fender systems within the James River, just south of Hog Island Wildlife Management Area, which is this area north of the power plant right here, to the James City County shoreline about 1 mile north of Skiff's Creek. This is Skiff's Creek. It will result in 49,652 square feet of subaqueous bottom impacts. The fender systems, that's for the towers, the fender systems require pipe pile foundations and will impact 2,712 square feet of river bottom. There are two channel crossings, one here and the main shipping channel here, that both require fender systems to protect the two towers on either side. So the project requires a total of 21,705 linear feet of actual aerial line crossings of the James River, and up to 217 linear feet of crossing of Wood Creek and Skiff's Creek combined, as well as a total of 147 linear feet of crossings of the Lee Hall Reservoir and the Harwoods Mill Reservoirs. All of the crossings outside the James River, in other words, the Woods Creek, Skiff's Creek reservoirs, will be spanned with no structures actually placed within the actual tidal creek or reservoirs. So I'm going to run through the project drawings as fast as possible, but still covering the impacts. So again, this is an overview of the project. You'll note kind of an odd alignment here. Dominion can probably address that in more detail, but some of this alignment shift was due to aerial concerns of the towers with flight patterns related to both the Newport News Airport and Port Eustis as well. So we're starting where it just exits the shoreline at Surry County from the power plant. This location is near the intake, the water intake for the power plant, which runs up to the power plant and then outfalls over here. So these are the James River crossings. Everywhere you see one of these little numbers, it's a tower. I'll go into a little more detail of those on some separate drawings. This is just kind of an overview. This is the first small boat channel crossing, so there'll be two fender systems here. And then it turns to the north. Again, each one of these is a tower location. And let me go back. This is the main channel, and then it hits the shoreline over on the James City County side. This is the Woods Creek crossing. This is a substation, which I'll talk a little bit about, that we don't have any jurisdiction over, but there's some information you might need to know about that related to the project. We'll go through this substation and then continue on across Skiff's Creek. And then this is just a continuation of that slide. Then it crosses the reservoirs, Lee Hall in a couple spots, and Harwoods Mill at this location. And then continues, that's just an extension of the reservoir, and then goes to the south. So I'll go through these pretty quick. These just give you the typical foundations. There's a number of different size towers that will be placed in the James River, depending on the water depth and the height of the towers. So the smaller foundations you see here will be the more shallow water. So you can see that each one of these will have 4 feet, but there are separate piles underneath these feet, and I'll discuss that in more detail in a moment. Again, just technical drawings of the footprint of the actual feet. And you can note the number of types of towers. Again, this is another overview. So the fender systems, and I'll go back to talk about the towers and some of the line heights of the line in a moment. So this is a typical of the fender system for the channels that they'll have to impact. So there will be pilings for these as well, and then a fender system attached. Again, here's the alignment. And again, similar design on both channels. You see the number of piles, 60 per fender. Previous one, I don't have the impacts on that one. So again, this is shows the fender system, basically pilings with whalers, typical of what you'd see on any fender type system that we approve. So now we're talking about the clearances of the line itself. This is, again, an overview slide. So right here, we have a minimum vertical clearance of 188 feet for the small boat channel. Caught up here. This is the main shipping channel, so minimal clearance. So this is the clearance underneath the lines as they sag between the two poles. It would be 201 feet. And these are the typical just cross-sectional views. This is where it enters the James River, and you can see each tower. Again, it's hard to see in these photos, but this is, I'll show you a blow-up of each one of these. But you see each tower, some of the towers are differently shaped, and obviously different heights. The individual heights of each tower is on the it ranges in height. From this, the shorter towers as it leaves Surrey County are about 70 feet. Of course, the large towers over the shipping channel are much, much taller. The towers as it leaves Surrey County are 138 feet high. The next one's 134. Then they go to 159 in height for two more towers. And then when it gets to the main shipping channel, those two towers are 297 feet tall. And then it drops back down as it gets closer to the James City County side to 189 feet. And again, these are just typical. Here's the tall towers and the minimum clearance. All of this has been vetted by the proper authorities for shipping and the height of the towers for air traffic. It's part of the federal project review of it as well. I'll discuss that in detail in a moment. Again, these are typical crossings as it gets to Skips Creek and the reservoirs. So these are just the typical types of towers you'll see. These are standard towers you see along all Dominion right-of-ways. Those two are the tall ones at the two channel crossings. And then this is just a typical view of looking at what the line would look like if you were looking across Skips Creek, but there are no actual towers in Skips Creek. It would just be the aerial encroachment. Again, looking at Skips Creek and power lines. So the issues. Since initiating the public interest reviews of this project, we did receive a number of protests and comments from affected property owners, environmental and resource entities, and Virginia residents. Now this is to date, and that's now not out of date because we've received quite a few protests since this evaluation was written last week. So the people you see listed in your actual evaluation are the ones we had up until the evaluation was written early last week. Since that time, we've been pretty flooded with protests and letters of support. And this is an approximate number because I was still getting them 5 minutes before I came in to the meeting today, but we've received approximately 1,000 letters or emails of protest for the project, and we've received just under 100 letters in support of the project. I'm not going to read all these names that are in the eval because there's 800, 900 more that we've received since then. But you can see it's a mix of conservation-type groups, and there is an adjacent property owner, which I'll address in just a second. And then a lot of these just individual names are just Virginia residents. This does impact, some of the towers do impact some oyster ground leases in the James River. It was protested by two leaseholders originally. Dominion worked with those leaseholders, and they withdrew their protest, so we have no objections from any oyster leaseholders concerning the project that does impact their leases. The BASF Corporation also wrote us a letter early on with concerns related to the crossing of their Highland property on the James City County side, but they appear to be outside of our jurisdiction because they were upland issues. Again, the oyster leaseholders have signed withdrawal forms, so they no longer object. Of the remaining protestants, they listed a number of concerns with the project to include potential impact to historic, cultural, scenic, and natural assets in the area and possible impacts to Atlantic sturgeon, impacts to tourism. Other concerns involve recreational use of the river and requests that VMRC carefully consider the impacts of the proposal as part of the agency's public trust responsibility. Many of the protestants questioned whether all alternatives were adequately addressed and considered by the applicant. So the concerns were that could this line have been run in a different location? Were the alternative locations properly vetted? Concerning that, the applicant did consider other routes and crossing methods, including installing these power lines under the river, subaqueous. None of the alternatives were considered feasible or cost-effective. As such, after considering all these alternatives, the State Corporation Commission and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have approved the aerial crossing to the James River as currently proposed. And I'll discuss a little more detail of each one of those actions. The State Corporation Commission originally approved the project in November of 2013. It was subsequently slightly modified on February 28, 2014, and their decision was confirmed in April of 2014. The orders from the State Corporation Commission were appealed by the BASF Corporation, James City County, Save the James Alliance Trust, and the James River Association, and went to the Virginia Supreme Court. The court ruled on April 16th of 2015, affirming the SCC's approval and certification of the transmission facilities, with a condition that Dominion obtain all local land use approval from James City County to construct the skiff station upland facility related to the project that I referenced earlier. The court issued a unanimous decision affirming the SCC's approval of the project and then denying any rehearing of the BASF court decision in May of 2015. The court issued its mandate and remand on June 5, 2015, returning the case to the SCC for further proceedings consistent with the views expressed in their written opinion. This order included a requirement that Dominion provide regular updates on the status of the certified project, including but not limited to the Skiff Station in James City County, the status of the Army Corps process, and the company's plans for maintaining system reliability in the Northampton Roads area. And Dominion has done those reports routinely since then. The Army Corps of Engineers reviewed the project for permitting in accordance with Section 404 of the Clean Water Act and Section 10 of the Rivers and Harbors Act. Their review of the project for permit involves an evaluation of the project impacts under the National Environmental Policy Act, the Endangered Species Act, and the National Historic Preservation Act. Under the National Environmental Policy Act, the Corps published a white paper in October of 2015 concerning an alternatives assessment and concluded that the project, as requested, meets the project's purpose and need and is practicable, and that other alternatives do not satisfy the project purpose, need, and or are not practicable due to cost, engineering restraints, or other logistics. after a request from the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation for further review of alternatives to the project, the Corps published on March 30th, 2017, an updated preliminary alternatives conclusion white paper, again confirming the findings that the project as requested meets the project purpose and need and is practicable, and all other alternatives do not satisfy the project's purpose and need and or are not practicable to cost due to cost, engineering restraints, or other logistics. Under the Endangered Species Act, the Corps consulted with the National Marine Fisheries Service. In a letter dated January 28, 2016, the National Marine Fisheries Service agreed with the Corps that the project is not likely to adversely affect listed species. Under the National Historic Preservation Act, a memorandum of agreement document was formulated under Section 106 of the National Historic Protection Act. Requires the Corps to take into consideration the effect of permitted activities on historic properties. This process commenced in August of 2013. Once the Corps determined a list of adversely affected properties, a mitigation plan or a memorandum of agreement, which I'll refer to again a couple of times, was developed, inviting numerous parties for consultation. A draft of the MOA was distributed to these parties in mid-March of this year and finalized in April of this year. Several of the parties signed the agreement during the months of April and May. Some parties did not sign it, and some of those remain protestants. The MOA does provide money for numerous projects as mitigation of any adverse impacts on historic properties from the proposed project. The agreement was signed by the Colonel of the Army Corps of Engineers and the President and CEO of Virginia Electric and Power on May 1st of 2017. And that document is in your packet. The Army Corps of Engineers permit. This is the reason that we're hearing it today, because we delayed action on finalizing approval of this or denial of this project in the Corps' full review, mostly because of these other acts that I just talked about that have federal impact. The Corps, on or about June 12th of this year, they provided to the applicant, Virginia Electric Power, with a provisional Department of Army permit. It's provisional because it's subject to signatures of the applicant and then obtaining either a permit or a waiver from the Department of Environmental Quality and either a permit or a waiver from the Marine Resources Commission. The Corps permit does have a special condition requiring a time of year restriction that will allow for pilings to only be driven on towers 21, 22, 24, 25, and 26, which are the four towers adjacent to the two channels and then one additional tower between those two that's in deeper water. So these are deeper water towers and pile driving. And the restriction is that they have to work on those towers during that November 16th through February 14th time frame only, and they can't work on them any other time. The Corps permit also requires the use of bubble curtains for all pile driving activity and the use of what's called ramp-up techniques for hammer intensity. So in other words, they start the pile drive, they start slow and ramp up the intensity. This is in hopes to alert fish that are in the area where they really start hammering the pilings in to avoid the area. The Corps permit does require all work to be completed by June 12th of 2020. VMRC did request comments from a number of sister agencies within the state, and the application has been the subject of extensive public hearings before a number of government entities. A summary of those actions follows, and I'll try to truncate these a little bit. Department of Environmental Quality originally did recommend implementing and maintaining erosion and sediment controls through all phases of the construction and to comply with the Clean Waters Act and the Commonwealth's wetland mitigation policies. There are no tidal wetland impacts for this project. A permit or waiver is required by the Army Corps permit, as I stated earlier, from DEQ. In conversations with DEQ in the last 2 weeks, they have indicated to me that they will be issuing the waiver if we do issue our permit. Game and Inland Fisheries also commented on the project. They recommended their standard in-stream time of year restrictions related to anadromous fish, that no work be conducted in the river between February 15th and June 15th of any year. They also recommended some other typical comments that don't really apply to this project about isolating construction material, because there is no actual excavation with this project. They also did recommend coordination with NOAA Fisheries Service concerning impacts to Atlantic sturgeon. Of course, that was done. The department is also an adjacent property owner because they own Hog Island Wildlife Refuge, but they did not indicate that they had any objections as an adjacent property owner to that property. The Department of Conservation and Recreation noted that they had concerns regarding the visual impacts to the entire corridor of the scenic river designated Lower James River and surrounding historic and scenic areas, which includes considerable recreational attributes. The Division of Natural Heritage notes the presence of a number of species and concerns and recommends coordination with Game and Inland Fisheries and the Virginia Endangered Species Act. The Department of Forestry indicated that there would be no impacts. Department of Health indicated there was no concerns related to public drinking water from the project. The Virginia Department of Transportation indicated no anticipated traffic impacts other than minimal temporary impacts during construction of the project. Virginia Department of Historic Resources recommended coordination with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers regarding any adverse impacts to historic properties. However, the Virginia Department of Historic Resources director did sign the memorandum of agreement that I referenced earlier related to the historic impacts and mitigation on May 1st of this year. The Virginia Department of Aviation had previously noted that due to the proximity of the project to the Newport News Williamsburg Airport, that the A form number 7640 be submitted by the applicant to the FAA so that the airspace obstruction evaluation study could be initiated. While we have not received verification of submittal of this form, we have confirmed that the Federal Aeronautics Administration has actually determined the project will not be a hazard to air navigation. And there was some, again, realignment of the project early on related to airspace issues. Virginia Institute of Marine Science, who are scientific advisors, they had provided initial comments in January of 2015. They provided comments specific to Atlantic sturgeon as well as general comments on the entire project from a marine impact perspective. They noted if permitted and constructed, the routine operation of the project would not be expected to impact marine resources. So once the project is built, they don't anticipate impacts. Specifically, they stated neither construction nor operations will result in adverse impacts to Atlantic sturgeon, all other non-alicine, nekton, and mobile benthic species that use the James River. Additionally, the permanent losses of benthic habitat and infauna from the construction foundations and fenders are minimal in relation to the overall ecology and ecosystem functions of this water body. However, there are elements of the proposed construction process that may result in adverse impacts to alicines, American shad, and river herrings particularly. Therefore, they also recommend the use of traditional time-of-year construction restrictions for any in-stream work in the James River between February 15th and June 15th of any year to protect such species during their spawning migration. In light of information, more detailed information on the type and method of the pilings that were going to be used, we staff requested some additional updated VIMS comments this year. They did provide those to us on June 16th. Those comments were provided specific to the proposed use of hollow steel pilings for the towers and hollow fiber pilings for the fender system. For hollow steel pilings, it is noted that they differ from solid wood pilings or concrete in that they have been demonstrated to cause direct mortality to local marine fauna due to the trauma from the high level of noise generated by insertion of these pilings into the bottom. And therefore, their use in the aquatic environment raises serious concerns. VIMS notes that recent comments on a number of other recent applications where such pilings were proposed for VMRC permits, they note that the use of hollow fiber pilings are believed to be less noise-related, but to an unknown degree. For hollow steel pilings, VIMS recommends the use of ramp-up methods, bubble curtains, and limiting driving pilings to only one tower location at a time. Additionally, to further mitigate the impact, they suggest the use of cushion blocks and isolation chambers. VIM states that the isolation chambers are especially beneficial in deeper waters where currents can dilute or eliminate the effectiveness of bubble curtains by causing the deterioration of the functional bubble envelope around the pilings. They also continue to recommend suspending the installation of steel hollow pilings regardless of water depth during the typical time of year restriction of February 15th through June 15th as resident fish and crustacean reproduction and development occur during this period, with the less mobile pre-adult life stages being especially vulnerable to the effects of pile driving. Finally, they state that if suspension of pile driving during the full time of year period cannot be honored, then the application of a full suite of mitigated construction methods as just described be used. And I want to stop right here a minute and briefly discuss the bubble curtain issue. But that issue, just a little bit more background about what VIMS is recommending. So you can have bubble curtains that can be confined or unconfined. And bubble curtains that are confined, basically around the piling, provide an additional degree of effectiveness to the bubble curtain itself. So they're often used where there's a potential for high water current velocities to sweep the bubbles away, which is the case here in the deep water, particularly tower locations, because it is deep water. So they have been used on projects and found to be more effective than just the bubble curtain alone in deep water because of the sweeping away of the bubbles by the velocity of the current. Moving on with other entities' comments, the County of Surrey noted that there were no wetland impacts associated with the project and that they would take no other action. James City County. The county noted concerns about possible impacts to historic resources in the area and also noted that the area is designated as a, quote, ultra-sensitive area for archaeological resources. They also noted concerns about upland construction impacts at the BASF property, concerns about the proposed switching station, and the need for a special use permit by the county for construction. Special use permits, based on the court ruling, the applicant has filed a special use permit application for rezoning, a substantial accord determination request, and a height waiver for the proposed switching station in the county. The local zoning board voted 4-2 to recommend denial of this station request. The matter remains pending before the Board of Supervisors, who, as of last I heard, were currently going to take up the matter at their July 11th, 2017 Board of Supervisors meeting. The switching station site plan has received conditional approval from county review departments and is also awaiting final approval by the Board of Supervisors. The City of Newport News has no objections. The Hampton Roads Planning District Commission noted no objections to the project but indicated they support it. The position of James City County, they support the position of James City County and that any construction of a switching station should be subject to local zoning. The United States Department of Interior, on behalf of the National Park Service, signed a memorandum of agreement for the impact mitigation on May 3rd. The Virginia Secretary of Natural Resources also signed that document on May 1st of this year. Again, the Federal Aviation Commission has reviewed it and deemed it's not a hazard to air navigation. United States Fish and Wildlife Service indicated they were awaiting action on removal of an inactive bald eagle nest and for one of the 230 kilovolt structures to be replaced. I have no other information on that, but that's really outside of our jurisdiction. Environmental Protection Agency. So related to the Yorktown plants, there's a mercury and air toxin standard extension request that BEPCO made related to the Yorktown plants, and it's called the MATS. The company received this extension on the existing Yorktown plants, which this project is basically meant to replace the power that they're going to lose by closing down those plants. They did get an extension through April of this year due to the delay in getting their construction permits for this project. There was a legal challenge to the MATS regulation that resulted in the courts remanding this back to the EPA. The EPA officially published the final rule in April of last year, which did not change the necessity for the project to move forward because of the closing of the Yorktown plants. As a result, the company has sought and received approval from the CERC Reliability Corporation and PJM to install, and those are abbreviations which I couldn't find any what they mean, but there are two companies. The Reliability Corporation oversees electricity, and the PJM company came up with this remedial action scheme beginning in April of this year, which would allow Virginia Electric and Power to cascade power outages on the peninsula should contingency conditions occur after the retirement of the Yorktown unit. So they basically be an authority to do some rolling blackouts if the demand is too high until this project could come online. Summary and recommendation. The magnitude of this project has resulted in extensive public interest review and public comment. Staff has carefully evaluated, well, let me back up just a minute. We received about 1,000 protests and several hundred letters of, couple hundred letters of support for this. Again, they're not all in your packet because almost the vast majority of them came in after we had done the evaluation and written the evaluation. The stack of papers is over there is a list of most of the protests and the and I have a few more that we just printed today. So there was a lot of public comment on this project. We have carefully evaluated the direct impacts to both shellfish and finfish and considered all the factors and consulted with other agencies as required by the Code of Virginia, 28.2.1205 A and B. Based on these evaluations and the mitigation techniques that the applicant has agreed to implement concerning the installation of the river towers and fender system, such impacts should be reduced and mitigated to the greatest extent practicable while allowing the project to be constructed. Staff believes the review of the project by the Army Corps of Engineers under the auspices of the National Environmental Protection, the National Environmental Policy Act and the Endangered Species Act and the National Historic Preservation Act have adequately addressed those issues through their provisional permit and will provide for mitigation of impacts as required by these acts for the project. Alternatives analysis were conducted and carefully evaluated by both the SCC and the Army Corps of Engineers, and alternatives were deemed to not meet the requirements or were too costly to implement. Therefore, after evaluating the merits of the project and concerns expressed by those in opposition to the project, and after considering all the factors contained in 28.2.1205A of the code, we recommend approval of the project with the following special conditions. All in-stream piling installations shall utilize bubble curtains, isolation chambers, cushion blocks, and ramp-up methods. No hollow steel pilings shall be installed between February 15th through June 15th of any year. In-stream pile driving of hollow steel pilings shall be confined to one tower at a time. And this last slide I have up is to highlight why we are supporting the VIM's recommendations related to the time of year. This is basically a number and location of state gill nets in the James River in 1983. And you can see that there are quite a few in this general area of the James River. The point of this slide that was sent to us by VIMS is to highlight that there are fish species in the James River year-round that could be impacted by these pile-driving activities. But particularly during the time of year restriction, typical time, they're more susceptible because of the migration and the juveniles who are more susceptible to impacts from the pile driving. So we do support that continued recommendation. However, if the commission were to determine that the time of year restriction is not feasible, staff would still recommend that all of these other conditions that I just listed be part of the project. So again, these are the conditions we're recommending. We believe Dominion has now agreed to one tower at a time. There was some discussion that the project could not be completed unless they could work on multiple towers at the same time. We are still recommending a single tower at a time, and I'm sure Dominion will address that here. We did put in our conditions that should the commission deem that that was not, make the project not feasible to be completed, because both the SEC and the Corps have given a deadline of this project to be done by June of 2020. That is possible they could get an extension of that, but that is the current language in the Corps permit. So we do support, again, the use of bubble curtains on all towers and fender pile driving. Bubble curtains on all towers. Applications shall use cushion blocks, which we understand from their contractor that's built into their rig already, so that shouldn't be a problem. We do recommend these isolation chambers to increase the effectiveness of the bubble curtains, and we do still recommend the time of year activity restriction from February 15th to June 15th and one tower at a time. In addition, the recommended royalty for the project for the impacts is $170,083. That's based on the river tower impacts of 49,211 feet at $2 per square foot for $98,422. The fender system encroachments, 2,712 feet at $2 per square foot of $5,424. And the aerial line encroachment over the rivers and creeks and reservoir at $3 per linear foot for a total of $66,237, which brings you to that total of $170,083. I'd be happy to try to answer any questions.
Well, that was simple. That was clear. I think we all got it. Before I open the floor for the commission to ask questions, the Attorney General's office has reviewed legal jurisdictional issues, and I'm going to ask Ms. Block here to help frame those for the board, because it may give you a better idea of what questions you want to ask or what you think is already addressed. Ms. Block, please.
So the VMRC's authority over this comes from 28.2.1205. This statute is specifically geared to considering the use of submerged state-owned bottomland. That is what you're considering. You're not considering any of the upland construction. In making this decision, you have to take into account the public trust doctrine, consider the project's effect on other reasonable and permitted uses of state water and the bottom land, the effect on marine and fisheries resources, the effect on tidal wetlands, the effect on adjacent or nearby properties, the effect on water quality, and the effect on submerged aquatic vegetation. Now, there is an Attorney General opinion on the boundaries of the effect on adjacent or nearby property, which limits the consideration to direct physical effects on adjacent or nearby properties. I will also say, as you heard from staff, there's been a lot of consideration by other agencies. It is not necessarily your role to question the efficacy of other reviews, such as federal reviews. There is a presumption that those were conducted in accordance with the law. And I think that's pretty much the boundaries of what this board is empowered to consider. Does anybody have any questions?
I assume there are questions from the commission. Raise your hands, I'll call you. Mr. Tankard.
I would just like to ask if we think alternatives have really been fleshed out. I see in the letter from Save the James Alliance, they mentioned that the coal fire plants that are being shut down could be made into liquid natural gas or just natural gas itself. And that wasn't an alternative that was explored. Do you know anything about that, Mr. Stagg?
Well, I'll really defer the detailed answer to Binion Power to answer that question, but there were numerous alternative methods from the very beginning looked at by this project. and they were vetted considerably by the SCC during their hearings and the Army Corps, which produced that white paper. And they both determined that they believed they were properly vetted. That's really all I can say about that. Mm-hmm. Dominion may have some more information specific to your exact question about converting to the Yorktown plan.
Other questions to the commission? Mr. Erskine.
I have a technical question maybe for Mr. Stagg. When you mentioned 1,000-some letters of protest and maybe a few hundred letters of support, were those unique letters or were those form letters?
The vast majority of the protest letters or emails were really template language that was, you know, somebody just signed the exact same. And most of them were really, the vast majority of them were about historic, the impact to the river from historic viewshed type issues. We did receive some comments from Colonial Williamsburg, Danger of Reliance, some conservation type groups that talked about that issue as well, but also about the possible impact to fish and sturgeon in particular. But the vast majority of the 1,000 were really sort of just template type letters imploring us under our public trust doctrine to carefully review this project, particularly related to historic viewshed impacts.
Okay, thank you.
In case somebody doesn't, I anticipated somebody to ask this and I meant to say it when I was in it, but the total number of pilings, somebody might want to know what that is, because it's 17 towers, but it's 656 pilings.
Right.
Each tower footprint has a number of pilings, so each one of those feet of the 4 feet has a number, and the fender, of course, system has a number of pilings, but that's the total number of pilings that have to be driven. So, I mean, that is a significant impact related to pile driving.
Other questions from the commission? Mr. France.
Yeah, I know that from February 15th to June 15th, there will be absolutely no construction, or is that just considered into the pile?
No pile driving.
No pile driving, but other,
other
construction can go on?
Right. The other thing that was discussed that late last week was the one or more towers per, you know, could they work on more than one tower at a time? And Dominion can address this more in detail, but my understanding is that they, when we had this discussion earlier, they thought that they couldn't do anything but just work on a piling, on a tower. And they couldn't even mobilize a second set of gear at a second location to get ready. And that, and again, they'll speak to this more in more detail, but my understanding is that they, as long as they can stage their next tower area, which we believe is really more like normal navigational type activity, we can't stop, you know, barges and stuff from navigating the river. I believe they're agreeable to the one tower. I don't think they are agreeable to the time of year, because the number of towers, and I think you'll hear them say that they're restricted on these five towers in the deep water, that they have to do those between November and the February time frame. So that further constricts them in when they can get the rest of them done, because they've got to work on those in that pretty narrow number of months. But they'll address that, I think, in more detail.
I have another question. These methods of driving pilings are to protect migrating fish species in the spring. I understand that. But is there any information or anything known how this affects shellfish on the bottom, or does it?
I would defer to VIMS if they would like to address that issue.
Law Vernell, VIMS. Mr. France, we're relying, none of this research that we reference in our response was done from VIMS. This is all mainly industrial research. There's very little peer-reviewed research on this. And it has focused mainly on Necton, the swimming species. We have no information on bottom species for this. Unfortunately, that's the answer I have to give you.
All right, thank you.
Other questions? Mr. Erskine.
Mr. Varnell. I have a follow-up question along Mr. France's questioning. And this is a highly productive area of the James River for oyster recruitment. And I guess my question is, I understand there's no literature, peer-reviewed literature, surrounding this, but what is your opinion on what Ms. Block said about a concern our jurisdiction is over water quality impacts and natural resources in terms of potential recruitment with the disruption of putting in these pilings? I realize it's not directly in that area, but it's adjacent, I would imagine. The recruitment would or would not be impacted in this area, in your opinion?
Are you referring to every species that may be in the river at that time?
Or oyster recruitment.
Just oyster recruitment.
Yes, sir.
let me expand on that. Yes. We took that into account. We looked at that. Just for the record, the way we do these reviews at VIMS, especially for these larger complex projects, is we collect everyone in VIMS who has expertise that may some form of relationship to the issues at hand, and we coordinate that to the Office of Research and Advisory Services. That was discussed, and we feel that was fairly embraced through the time of year for that period, and for what is required in the course permit. What we do know from the literature is that size matters when it comes to the effects of these pressure waves from these pilings. Smaller the size, it appears that has more impact on an organism. And as you well know, the larvae are at the power of the tides, the currents. They can't get away if they're there, and if a ramp up will not work for those. So from what we can I guess comfortably and confidently ask you to consider is that the traditional time of year restriction with what we have put in the thing, we feel that encompasses about everything that we feel should be captured for that. Yes, it's a hollow steel piles are just a unique product that has such an elevated level of concern for us. They're fairly new to the Bay Area, and you know, from research we know and from practice we know that they have additional impacts. So we're very careful with when we look at these, and hopefully that's in our comments that you can notice that. So hopefully I've answered your question, Mr. Erskine.
Yeah, I might have a follow-up later, but thank you.
Sure. I'm here.
Other questions from the commission? Mr. Tackert.
I have one more. Keypone. Unfortunately, when you think of the James River, keypone is something that comes to mind. And you didn't mention that in your briefing that I remember. And with 656 pilings, what is the danger of keypone being released into the river?
You did get one letter of protest asking about that issue. I'll make a quick answer, and I'll defer again to VIMS. But we did discuss this with VIMS. There was a study released that I think VIMS can reference within the last 2 years of the impact. Current thinking about the keypone, the impact in this stretch of the river was limited to some degree anyway because it's so far away from Hopewell. I think the result of that study was that in this area of the James River, the detectable levels are detectable, but that the levels are lower than the danger that's been established by the government. And I don't have to, reiterate any comment we have about that. But based on what they told us from the studies and the information they sent us, we don't believe that this will really have any impact related to keepholding.
Ms. Vernell, could you flesh that out a little bit for us?
I certainly can.
Thanks, sir.
That's a very good question. It is an area of concern that we also took into account when we looked at this project. Every project in the James River we consider keepone. It's still out there. And I guess I'll expand on a little bit just for the record, but we have no concern with this project from that. The reason being is for 40 years we've studied this issue in the James. We've analyzed over 13,000 samples, fish samples and sediment samples and water samples. We just did, Dr. Mike Unger of VIMS just did a study last year and published it a couple of months ago. It was funded by the Virginia Environmental Endowment. There's some really good news about KEPO. A third of the samples that were taken were lower than the detectable level. It's still out there. It's mostly in the sediments, maybe unknown to people. It never reached toxic concern in the water, ever. What the concern was biomagnification from bottom feeders up through the food chain to where it became a human health concern. And it still remains a human health concern in a lot of places. Large projects, we always take this into account, and the only time that we are concerned with KEPONE is if it is a large dredging project, something that disrupts the bottom sediments to a deep degree and in a large area. That could release KEPONE. However, even in the larger projects, and even through storms that may disrupt the bottom, which sometimes is more burial than release, we don't feel, or our environmental chemists do not feel, that have dealt with this for so many decades, that it could ever reach a level that it biomagnificates, again, up through the food chain to become a human health concern. Actually, if the trends continue like we have seen in our data, everything will be below the detection level in about 2020 to 2025. And this project has no dredging. This project has pile driving. We don't consider that to be a large enough effect, even at the hundreds of pilings here, that would disrupt the bottom to the degree that probably is even detectable in the water column. So I guess that's a long way to say we have no concern about KEPONE in this particular situation.
Well, thank you.
Mm-hmm. It's good to hear good news about KEPONE for the first time in, what, 40 years, 50 years? Other questions from the commission? Mr. Stagg, thank you. But please don't go anywhere.
Yeah, I think I'll hang around.
Thank you. Dominion, it's your turn here. You have a designated spokesperson. Please come forward here. Raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear? You'll tell the truth today, the whole truth and nothing but the truth, so help you God. Please state your names for the record in the microphone. We tape record all of our commission meetings, and the conversations are posted on our website.
My name is Kevin Curtis.
Welcome, Mr. Curtis.
My name is Corey Gray.
Welcome, Mr. Gray. Do you have a PowerPoint presentation, or what do you have in mind?
As this is loading, I want to say thank you to the commission for the opportunity to have this very important conversation. We're here to address concerns and answer questions. I'm currently the Vice President of Technical Solutions at Dominion Energy, electrical engineer by training with extensive experience in transmission planning and system operations at the transmission level. So I've been involved with this project from the beginning and very involved and detailed experience with how our system operates under stress. All right, want to thank the staff and Mr. Stagg for doing a very thorough presentation this morning. Some of that material I had in my presentation to cover for you, and in the interest of brevity, we'll skip over it.
Thank you very much.
But I do want to emphasize a few points. I want to emphasize the criticality of need. We first recognized the need for more infrastructure on the peninsula back in 2011. And if you think about the geographic nature of the peninsula, it's by nature surrounded on three sides by water. That limits the amount of infrastructure that we have on the peninsula. And we recognized 6 years ago that in the future, just based on the growing load and economic development, military presence on the peninsula, that we were going to need additional transmission infrastructure. What happened in 2012, Mr. Stagg described, was a reaction to the MATS requirements for coal-fired units, being in particular, in this case, Yorktown 1 and 2. So in order to meet emissions requirements, we announced in 2012 that we would need to retire those two coal units at Yorktown. Yorktown's the only power station on the peninsula, limited transmission infrastructure. So when you take that generation infrastructure out of the mix, it created an immediate need for the project that was much sooner than what we were seeing prior to the Yorktown retirement. So now it wasn't just about future load growth at some point in our future time period. It was loss of those two units mean we're now in a critical situation. Mr. Stagg mentioned NERC, the North American Electric Reliability Corporation. That is a group designated by FERC to manage the mandatory standards on transmission owners, among many other things. Those standards became mandatory in 2007 as a result of the 2003 blackout that you may remember that happened in the Northeast. It started on a first energy system. There were some issues with loading, with vegetation, with operator response, with not actually managing the load. We talked about load shed, we'll get back to that. Not managing the stress on the transmission grid. And that outage cascaded to the point of affecting over 60 or 51 million people from Ohio all the way to Canada. That was in 2003. So over the next 4 years, between acts of Congress and FERC, the standards became mandatory in 2007. So as a transmission owner, Dominion is responsible and accountable for those mandatory standards. And that, when we talk about NERC and reliability violations, that's what drives the assessment and the criteria so that all transmission owners are looking at risk, not being too conservative and not taking too much risk that's inappropriate. We also mentioned PJM in Mr. Stagg's. We heard about PJM in his presentation. PJM is what we call the Regional Transmission Organization. A letter here on the slide from one of their vice presidents. PJM oversees a large portion of the transmission grid in the Mid-Atlantic. It's over 60,000 miles of transmission lines. We're about 10% of that mix. PJM is an authority with experts to look at a broader system to really assess risk and decide what are the most appropriate solutions to solve that problem. They've been involved in this project and approved it from the beginning. They've approved the need. They've approved the solution. They've revalidated as the load forecast has changed over the number of years that we've been doing working on this project. And then recently, January of this year, sent a letter validating it again, the need for infrastructure support, the criticality of it, and they've also, as we'll talk about with alternatives, they've recognized the alternatives. You've already seen a picture of the project. Mr. Stagg recognized the Virginia State Corporation Commission. They're another one of the key parties that assess the need and the alternatives. Mr. Tankard, you asked about alternatives. I'll show a list of some of those. That's part of what the State Corporation Commission does. We mentioned the Army Corps of Engineers done the same thing, looking at need and alternatives with two white papers on alternative analysis. The MOA that Mr. Stagg referenced, the Memorandum of Agreement, is roughly $90 million to help address the mitigation of the project, with some very important stakeholders that have been involved in the process throughout and that have signed on. In particular, I highlight the Virginia Secretary of Natural Resources has signed on to that agreement. And the National Marine Fisheries Service has also stated that this project is not likely to affect listed species. Here's a list of alternatives. We've looked at a dozen alternatives, generation alternatives, transmission alternatives, additional alternatives put forth by stakeholders that work in the industry. The SEC has evaluated alternatives that I referenced earlier. PJM has validated the list of alternatives. And the same answer comes back from all of those groups that the need still exists and the best project, the best solution is the Skiff's Creek project. It's the most practicable, it's the most effective solution. And any of the other solutions don't meet the need or have issues around constructability, cost, or just aren't practicable, or don't satisfy the NERC requirements. So I want to end just to reemphasize the importance of service to the peninsula, the customers that live and work on the peninsula. Approximately 600,000 people live or work on the peninsula on a daily basis. There's a significant military presence on the peninsula and significant presence of what we call our key account commercial industrial customers and a large number of residents. So we appreciate your time and attention. Certainly here to answer questions. And I want to make sure you appreciate the sense of urgency around this project. If you'd rather Mr. Gray finish his part and do questions, or we can...
Yes, sir. Let's have Mr. Gray give his presentation, then we can have questions.
All right, thank you. I'm Corey Gray with Stantec. I've been assisting Dominion with the permitting for this project, and I also want to thank the commission for allowing me to speak. We just have up here the Virginia statute governing the issuance of permits to subaqueous bottoms. Mr. Curtis just kind of went through why this project, we feel that it's certainly in the public need to provide the electrical reliability and power for the peninsula. And I'm just going to kind of take you through some of the other six items to discuss as briefly. Mr. Stagg already discussed those in quite a bit of detail, so I'm going to try to be brief on those. All right, here's just another view of the project. There are multiple crossings of VMRC jurisdictional waters. The only crossing that has any direct impacts to the subaqueous bottom, of course, is the James River crossing. The rest of them just simply span either tidal water bodies, including the wetlands that are associated with them, or other streams that are under VMRC's jurisdiction. So I'm going to focus primarily on the James River crossing, the 500 kV line. So one of the items, of course, that the commission will be considering is the other uses of state waters and bottomlands. Dominion took quite a bit of care to design this project to try to minimize effects to navigation and commerce. As Mr. Stagg had discussed, the structures are set back from the secondary and the federal channels. The Corps has already issued their 408 permit that allows for work that may affect federal navigation, and they came to the conclusion that it would not adversely affect navigation. The fender systems are also, and the structures are also outside of the spoil area that the Corps discharges when they dredge the federal channel, where they discharge the spoils to the side over here. There are the minimum distances set back from federal channels that are required, and the clearances that Mr. Stagg spoke about as well. All these structures are going to have the core permit, I should say, requires lighting on specific structures for navigational purposes for boating, and that's all in accordance with Coast Guard requirements. Dominion has come to an agreement with all of the oyster leaseholders within the area, and they are not currently protesting the project. And with the 17 structures in the river, it's not going to affect the free flow of the river itself. So one of the primary issues, of course, that is being considered is the impact to marine resources and the fisheries. Way back into 2015, Dominion has been coordinating with VIMS and VMRC to kind of look at these mitigation measures to try to reduce the impact to fisheries resources. And I'm going to discuss those in detail a little bit later, the ones that Dominion's in agreement with VMRC on. The National Marine Fisheries Service also did quite a bit of consultation for this project, specifically on endangered species and, in particular, the federally endangered Atlantic sturgeon. They came to the conclusion that the project would not adversely affect the Atlantic sturgeon. They looked at the impact, quite a bit of detail, the impact of sound to the Atlantic sturgeon, looking at what the sound would be with or without mitigation measures. And as a requirement of the permit from the Corps, mitigation measures would be used in any case. The National Marine Fisheries Service has also assessed the effects to anadromous fish. And essential fish habitat, which includes habitat for important recreational sports fish, and came to the conclusion that it is not likely to adversely affect that as well. And in their analysis, they also looked at the effects from potential turbidity from the actual pile driving activities and found that any increase in turbidity would be limited in short term in scope. So as Mr. Stagg kind of explained, the project expands all tidal wetlands. There's no tidal wetland impacts as a result of this project. On the adjacent properties, again, Dominion has come to an agreement with all of the oyster lease holders. There are no direct physical or ecological effects on adjacent properties as a result of that subaqueous encroachment. There is no submerged aquatic vegetation within the project area. As far as water quality, as I just mentioned, the Marine Fisheries Service came to the conclusion that impacts from turbidity would be limited in scope and time. This isn't a dredging project, so we don't have that to worry about. And also that the memorandum of agreement that has been signed to address the effects of the historic properties, it also includes a number of provisions for projects to be funded that would improve water quality throughout the Lower James River watershed. So going on to the mitigation measures that the VMRC has recommended, as Mr. Stagg indicated, Dominion is in agreement with pretty much all of those. The ramp-up method, it's pretty standard operating for all projects, and the bubble curtains with the isolation casings, definitely agreeable to use that. I have a picture to show of one of those in a moment. Cushion blocks, the pile driving at one tower location at a time. Pile driving would only occur at one pile at a time, so they may be mobilizing at a separate location, but they would not have simultaneous pile driving. And then, of course, the Corps is requiring the time of year restriction for the deep water habitat. The one issue that presents a significant issue for Dominion's construction schedules to get the project up and running and to get the reliable power to the peninsula is the February 15 through June 15 time of year restriction. So I have a graphic here to show essentially the when certain pile driving activities can occur based upon what the Corps time of year restriction is, which is here on the left, basically the deep water piles. That is a permit condition and the Corps permit that's been proffered, as well as the February 15 to June 15 time of year restriction from VMRC recommendation. And the primary concern, I mean, Dominion's not going to be doing construction in the deep water areas at any point. It's the shallow water areas, the 12 structures that are within the shallow water. And when you combine that with the fact that during the period between basically November 15 through February 14, Dominion's really got to be focused on that deep water water work. It's not the best time of year to be working out on the river. You have storms and such that come up. It can really constrain the remaining time period that they would be able to do work essentially in that shallow water area. It's only a few, 5-6 months out of the year. So Dominion, understands that obviously it's, standard to have that time of year restriction, and it is the most protective of the resources out there. However, we're respectfully requesting to allow year-round pile driving activities in the shallow water environment, including all the other mitigation measures that VMRC and VIMS has recommended. We feel that this is aligning with the recommendations and from VIMS and VMRC. If that time of year restriction could not be honored, which Dominion feels that it would be a pretty heavy burden on the project, it will allow Dominion to meet their construction schedule. And again, based upon some of the information that NOAA had done in their analysis for impacts to Atlantic sturgeon, the sound information, and some of the information that's out there on the effects of some of the mitigation measures, in particular the isolation casings and the bubble curtains, we feel that this would help to minimize the impact to any fish that would be present in that area. Essentially, they're not going to be doing any work in the deep water habitat during that time of year when the fish are migrating through, so they'll be in the shallower water, and that those mitigation measures that are there should hopefully protect those fish. So just wanted to show a picture of kind of what we're talking about with that the bubble curtains. This on the left, this one actually does not have the isolation casings. This just kind of just is a good graphic showing the bubbles coming up while they're doing pile driving activities here. The one on the right, this photo is actually out of one of the studies that VIMS cites. I believe it's the Caltrans study that looked at a variety of different mitigation methods for reducing impacts from pile driving. And this right here, that's basically the casing around the hollow steel pile that's being driven. You can see all the bubbly water kind of coming up, and it's kind of held in place there. So I believe this system achieved about a 20 to 25 decibel reduction in sound, which essentially put it below thresholds for injury impact. So just to kind of sum up and conclude that, Dominion feels that we've met the requirements of the statute, and the project is clearly in the public interest, that we have little or have minimized impacts to all of the resources of concern to VMRC, and that we would respectfully ask that you would authorize the activity for the issuance of a permit and allowing work within that February 15 through June 15 window for the shallow water areas. So thank you, and if you have any questions.
I suspect there will be. Are there questions from the commission? Mr. Tankard.
Well, I'll ask, repeat my question about the, you read in the paper, coal fired plants are being converted to natural gas at a pretty regular rate across the country. Why aren't we doing that here in Yorktown?
Yeah, I wanted to come back to that because I meant to cover it on the alternatives. We looked at that as an option. There's not currently capacity on the peninsula to power a station for conversion. That was looked at, and it gets into the order of $1 billion-plus when you include the pipeline in the facility. You also referenced LNG, I believe, in your early question. LNG comes over, and it's liquefied because it's cold. You need a facility to turn that back into a gas. You just don't have the infrastructure to support conversion of those units. And the cost is cost prohibitive. It was looked at with all the other options and what would be the most viable, most functional solution. And as a very long period of time, if we were to embark on a multi-billion-dollar investment to try to get the infrastructure to the peninsula to provide that gas.
Mm-hmm. So follow-up question. So really it's a situation of the gas coming to the plant is your issue.
Right. That's exactly right.
Okay.
While we're discussing costs, what's the cost of this project as proposed?
It's roughly about $285 million, and that includes the $90 million for mitigation. So it's roughly $190 million for the project, $90-$95 for mitigation.
Well, I'm anticipating a question or a line of questioning later on today here. You looked at directional drilling as well.
Yes, we did.
That was part of the SEC evaluation. As I understand.
Yes, we did.
Was a dollar ever put on the cost if this was directionally drilled into the water body?
Well, there's two issues with that. One is, can you get the capacity that you need with infrastructure that is in directional drilled? It's not
as
simple.
Can you?
No, you can't get the capacity that we need with the
cable
and the voltage that we need. It's a technical issue, and if you remember the reference to the one line on the project, it's 500,000 volts overhead. There's a difference in the way the transmission system operates. You have higher voltage provides a strong resource. So tapping the 500 network at Surrey provides a very effective, very strong resource into the peninsula. There's not anything in the world this distance in the capacity that we need at 500 kV.
Anywhere in the world?
Not this distance and the capacity that we need.
So if we ordered this directionally drilled, this would be a guinea pig. It's never been done anywhere on the planet. Is that what you're saying?
To this length and this capacity. We're talking about just a four-mile crossing.
Okay.
The other component, what if you did it at lower voltage? Then you're talking 18 cables, a lot more impactful to the environment, a lot more disruptive, because those cables don't span 4 miles.
And that's not the project in front of us.
That is right. That's correct.
So directionally drilled, even if it was engineeringly, if that's a word possible, what would the cost be?
You're up into $800 to $1 billion, easy if it's AC voltage. If we need the capacity, to get the capacity, another consideration we looked at was what's called DC configuration. You see those out west and other places, and that doubles the price of potential cost. But the environmental impact is much more significant if we try to go underground. Even with directional drill, we still have to bring the cables up above the surface to make the connections and make the splices.
Yep. Other questions to the commission? Mr. Erskine.
I had a question. In your presentation, you mentioned in the very beginning that it would not impact river flow. And I understand general river flow will not be impacted. Was there any evaluation done for disruption or changing hydrodynamic flow in the river?
Dominion did not do a study on that specifically. However, as part of the Corps process, when they go forth to assess a project, they have to go through their 404B1 guidelines, and they look specifically at circulation and water patterns, and would assess that. And they, you know, by issuance of the permit, they came to the conclusion that it certainly was not a significant adverse effect.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions from the commission? I got a couple more while we're at it here. How far would these towers, 297 feet, be from Jamestown?
If you have the, I know from the point, we're almost 4 miles, 3.5 to 4 miles in distance. I'm out on Jamestown Point.
Let's talk about the time of year restriction a bit. So as I understand your testimony here, Dominion could achieve the project goals and meet the deadlines doing one tower at a time in the shallow water, provided there's not a time of year restriction.
That's correct. It would be maybe multiple rigs, two rigs, but as we talked about, the movement of one rig to be setting up for another piling.
Okay.
You only have one rig driving pilings at a time.
Would you be able to meet the deadline if the time of year restriction was in place and the commission allowed two towers at a time?
I'm going to defer to our project manager, if I may.
Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Russell Meadows, and I'm the project manager.
Welcome, Mr. Meadows.
Thank you. The project, without being able to drive piles at, during that time of year restriction, we're limited to such a window of time to be able to work that there's no way that we could meet the time frame that we have existing right now. But you mentioned the fact of being able to drive two locations at once.
Correct.
It would help us, but it doesn't help us that much because there's so much setup involved, especially with the bubble curtain being a casing around it. The setup takes actually more time than it takes to drive the pile. So we're actually working and setting up the option of not having to, being able to drive it two times. It's that setup and then the drive. The drive is actually virtually not that much of time to do that.
Could you set up two or three towers at a time?
The availability of rigs, the marine contractor that we've hired to do this work is WF McGann, and they work in the Tidewater area extensively. They have the capabilities of having two rigs. To get a third rig, a rig would have to come in from somewhere else, which would mean we would have 3 to 4 setups. It takes multiple cranes, multiple barges to make one of these setups. I'd have to confer with them. We really haven't discussed trying to go to that many rigs because once you start setting up in the river, you start creating locations that impedes other traffic as well because there's a lot of barge and a lot of cranes at each location.
All right. Well, then let me ask flat out, if we reduce the time of your restriction, instead of 4 months, made it 3, and you did two towers, would you be able to get this all done within the time restrictions and the 2020 deadline?
There's a possibility. I wouldn't know for sure until I could, get a layout and get my contractor to give me a schedule.
Let me ask a real basic, very wide-ranging question. Is there a compromise from Dominion's standpoint on the time of year restriction? And if so, what would it be?
I mean, if there is a critical time as far as when these emerging and small aquatics are starting to emerge, if there's like a couple of months in front of that we could not drive and then have the ability to drive, a little bit later, possibly when they have better movement or something, that maybe we could work on something like that by splitting the time frame or working with the time frame.
It's roughly 18 to 20 months of construction, not recognizing any type of restrictions, but just actual construction time.
We'll hear from some others over the next hour or two. If you all get a chance to put your heads together while they're addressing the commission, maybe there is a compromise in here, maybe there isn't. But I think we'd like to hear it if there is one. Other questions from the commission? Thank you, gentlemen. Let's take this in order. Is there anybody in the audience here who wishes to testify in favor of this project? Please come forward. Thank you. Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you God? Yes, please state your name for the record.
My name is Lori Elaine Horner.
Welcome.
I live in Newport News, Virginia. I would like to convey my wishes to Mr. Stagg and to the Virginia Marine Resources Commission, each of you, that I would consider the proposed Surrey Skiffs Creek transmission line as favorable. By approving this transmission line, you will help ensure that nearly half a million people who are on the peninsula would have power and continued power, a continued supply of reliable energy that would be delivered to our area for years to come. Without a new transmission line, sir, we could face energy shortages, which we currently do now where we live. Our region will have cleaner energy. We will benefit from energy sources that cut carbon and other emissions by hundreds of thousands of tons each year. And we can keep our energy bills affordable. This transmission line is the best option to bring power to the peninsula at the lowest cost to customers. I understand that for the last 20 or 30 years ago, these types of projects weren't so controversial, but it is fortunate that we were approved and built back then, because we now have projects just like this one to thank you for the economic prosperity we see today on the peninsula. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, ma'am. Any questions from the commission? Thank you. Anybody else in the audience wish to be heard in favor? Please come forward. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Please state your name for the record.
My name is Randy Akers. I'm a Newport News waterfront property owner.
Welcome.
And I'd like to thank you for allowing me to speak. Just briefly, I wish to express my support for the Skiffs Creek Surrey Transmission Power Line project proposed by Dominion. The project makes good sense, especially as economic growth on the peninsula in recent decades has outpaced our need for reliable, stable, and affordable electricity. Hampton Roads needs this, Newport News needs this, and Williamsburg needs this. The need has been identified, and the route has been studied, and now it's time for action. I respectfully ask that the commission to consider the project favorably and allow it to move forward. And just as a side note, when I was printing off my statement, had a power outage, and due to a circuit issue at a power station. So I thought it's a sign. So thank you.
Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Anybody else wish to testify in favor? Please come forward, sir. Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Please state your name for the record.
All right. My name is Roy Hollowell.
Welcome, sir.
I'm a lifetime resident of the Tidewater area. My last 26 years, I've resided in the peninsula. Okay. I will make a qualifier. I am a retiree of Dominion of 4 years after 42 years. So anytime you hear me say we, it's because I worked there 42 years. Okay, but it's them. Also, the numbers that you hear, I might throw at you, is numbers that you can get on the internet. I didn't call Dom to get them information. So these are my numbers. And this is some of my relics that I have that I took with me when I retired as well. Okay. First of all, thank you for opening it to the public. I hope the public and yourself use this not only as a way to express, but to learn. I mean, I have learned a lot. Bubble wrap. Wow. Never knew what that was. So
welcome to our world.
Oh, I tell you. And I'll tell you, I'll use an old frame that my supervisor, my manager first taught me. If I'm rambling, just go to your nose, okay? And I'll shut up and move on. And I've tried to eliminate some of the stuff I've already heard covered.
Brevity is prized by this board.
Absolutely. I got 4 pages, but the fonts are 1 inch big, so it's not like
brevity is prized by this board.
All right, I did mention I am a lifetime resident, and I've been here for 26 years. My 42 years with Dominion, first 20 were in substation department. So I would call myself an expert when it comes to substations, so I guess I'll be talking about the Skiffs Creek with James City County. And then my last 22, that's when I moved to the peninsula in 1990. They gave me a nice opportunity to oversee the regional operations of power flow. Initially, it was on the peninsula, and then eventually I made it up to watch it from the Oregon Inlet Bridge to Providence Forge. So I'm pretty familiar with the power flow when it comes to that. In the substation department, my primary job was to construct them, to maintain them, and to assure that there's smooth operation of them.
Let's stick to the project at hand here.
Well, that last statement would be, I mentioned these only to support my role or my thing here. Two reasons why we're here. A is environmental, and B, reliability. And I now take off with A and B, because both of them are of equal importance. Okay? So I want to talk about, from the environmental standpoint, as 42 years with Dominion, I would tell you, when it came to the environmental process within Dominion, there was such support from my upper management on everything we did. In the substation, you had to deal with oil. You deal with oil. In the early makings of electricity, oil used PCB.
Please, all right, project.
I got
Thank
you.
You.
All right, well, make a bottom line short, reliability. You got me on the environmental. We are environmentalists, okay? Reliability, absolutely. Reliability is from the homeowner to all the way to the U.S. government right here. And was really interested when we've got to have good power. Not like your house power, but at the transmission level. Your house power, you cut the blow dryer on, your lights dim. That is totally, could not ever happen to the transmission, because we have to have the support. That's what substations do to tie all those transmission lines together. Okay? So hopefully from reliability, it's so important. How did we get in this jam? I say a jam. Well, two things is growth and environmental. We've been blessed with Virginia having such great resources that we have had a lot of growth in the state of Virginia and in the peninsula, even though some of the tough times we've been through. And it was interesting, I was looking at some of my relics. One of the most exciting nights of my career was that stroke of midnight, January 1st, 2000. Okay?
This project, please. The power line crossing.
I'm trying to support why we need reliability. We have added 38,000 meters on the peninsula. That's low.
There we go.
Okay. Very good. I understand, and I apologize. So, with the closing of the fossil fuel of the coal, it's super critical that we get power from Surrey, a zero-emission project, and building this project based on recommendations from everybody that I have heard. So, I highly recommend the building of the project. Thank you, and I apologize for my time.
It's okay. No, thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Do you hereby swear that the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record, sir.
Good morning. My name is Harold Bohannon, and I'm a resident of James City County, and I've been a peninsula resident for 35 years. I appreciate the opportunity to speak before you this morning. Over the course of my career, which dates back to the 1960s, I've seen firsthand just how important secure and reliable energy is to the peninsula. I saw it as a recent college graduate when I was employed by the Newport News Shipbuilding. I saw it during my 27 years as an employee of Dominion, where I had the opportunity to oversee some of the operations of Yorktown Power Station, and later to help major commercial and industrial customers meet their needs. And their big need is reliable energy. And I've seen it in my work with local governments. Throughout my career, all these businesses and government agencies could reasonably assume that they would have access to reliable energy supplies as much as they required whenever they needed it. Unfortunately, that assumption may not be valid in the very near future if the Skiffs Creek project is not approved. The two coal-fired generating units at Yorktown Power Station is one of the primary energy suppliers for the peninsula in the past, must cease operations due to environmental concerns. With the loss of these two generating units, the remaining generation and transmission system is not equipped to ensure that the peninsula has 24/7 access to adequate amounts of electricity, particularly during periods of high demand, such as extremely hot or extremely cold weather. Dominion has taken important steps recently to improve the system and lessen the possibility of disruptions, but those steps certainly are not considered permanent by the company, and neither should they be considered permanent by anyone else. That's why the Skiffs Creek transmission line across the James River is so important and vital. It will provide a new direct high voltage path for abundant supplies of energy to reach the peninsula. Much of it will come from the zero emissions, zero carbon Surrey Nuclear Power Station, which has used nuclear technology to produce electricity since the 1970s. As you know, Surrey is only miles away and directly across the James River. But the current transmission system severely limits the peninsula's ability to rely on this output. Once it begins operating, the Skiffs Creek project would change that situation immediately. There is opposition to the project, no question. I wonder if these opponents can imagine what would happen on the peninsula if someday the supply of power becomes unreliable. In addition to the negative impact on commerce and industry, what will be the impact on our tourist industry? Millions of visitors from all over the world have visited the peninsula and the historic areas there for many years. One of our paramount goals on the peninsula has been providing these visitors with safety and comfort. Both will be impacted by unreliable electric service and the threat of periodic blackouts. Also, basic services such as lighting, heating and cooling, and food processing will be interrupted, possibly with little or no warning. Visitors will find that automatic tellers, gasoline pumps, elevators, and credit and debit card payment systems fail to work. Under those circumstances, many people would think twice about coming to the peninsula. And if that happens, our region will sustain major economic damage. I'm convinced this project can and will be built in ways that protect the environment, including the James River. I also note that the project and its route across the James River has been approved by the State Corporation Commission, which found no viable alternative. Finally, I note that the U.S. Corps of Engineers recently said it would issue a permit for the project contingent on several upcoming rulings, including the one from this commission. In conclusion, I am convinced the Skiffs Creek project is essential not only for energy reliability on the peninsula, but also for the future health of our economy. I am convinced it will be built in a way that protects the environment and the river, and I am confident the project is the best alternative for resolving this serious situation. I respectfully ask this commission to approve the permit and allow this project to move forward without further delay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify in favor of this project? Anybody else in favor? Okay, let's go to the opposition here. There are some folks that oppose to this project. If you have a spokesperson, let's hear from them first. Please come forward, ma'am. Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? Please state your name for the record.
Thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Nancy Horgan. I am a resident of Newport News, waterfront owner, and I am speaking representing Hampton Roads Garden Club, which is a member of the Garden Club of Virginia. Our conservation chairman could not be here, so I'm reading her letter that I have greatly abbreviated after listening to the information today. Most of us living in Virginia share a reverence for the James River. More than an emotional connection, we hold a deep respect for its history, of which much can be said. But we also make our living alongside the James. We observe commercial harvesting of clams, oysters, crabs, and fishing during early dawn. The James River draws visitors, tourists, who enjoy recreation on its waters. Citizens and visitors swim, boat, fish, and wade in the James. This water also comes into our backyards through its estuaries. Our plant, marine life, and waterfowl are sustained by it. And yes, our regional pride has been built upon it. We are at this assembly to encourage you to disprove the permit being applied by Dominion Virginia Power. There is no doubt that the construction of these intrusive pilings, 656, all of which will not be in the James River, will disturb the subaqueous riverbed. The downflow of chemical and organic particulates during and after the digging of these pilings will negatively affect our ecosystem. Is it known what will be the long-term effect of this disturbance? We are asking you to deny the permit to allow time to find another way to transmit this state-of-the-art electrical power. Have all the alternatives been explored? When Dominion Power was doing their proposal of alternatives, did, if it was solely on cost, have they taken into account now the addition of changing the material that the towers will be built, the cushion blocks, curtain bubble blocks, isolation chambers, limiting time of year? These are factors that should have gone into the comparison of the alternatives. Also, when the different agencies were approached about approval for this alternative, were other alternatives suggested to them that they might find more favorable, or was there consideration just for this alternative? Could the federal installations on the peninsula, the probable main power consumer in our area, present to our community a plan for a less environmentally destructive solution? The cost of this proposed progress will be socialized across the region, as explained to me by a Virginia Power representative at an informational hearing. Does this mean a rate or tax increase? The public seems convinced by newspaper interviews that without it, we will have potential brownouts. The focus should be on how to do this with the least ecological risk, not just considering cost, but taking both economic and ecological environment into consideration. Deep within the riverbed, contaminants likely remain. We heard earlier about the keystone. In addition, how about the scores of years of shedding of chemicals from the Defense Ready Reserve Fleet, located right off Skiff's Creek, and others unknown? Virginia Marine Resources Commission decision will impact the future of the James River in other ways. A scenic waterway inviting tourism, stable property values and tax revenues for communities along shores, assurance of healthy environment for the seafood industry, and safe waterway transportation. We ask that you continue to protect our ecosystem of the James River. The Hampton Roads Garden Club asks you to vote no to this permit. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Bonus points for appropriate use of the word subaqueous. Any other spokesperson? Great. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth? You're an attorney. Never mind. Please proceed.
State your name. Cherie Williamson. I'm Associate General Counsel for the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Thank you all for your time this morning. Just to get started, I wanted to hand-deliver about 750 public comments that were submitted. Mr. Stagg noted that they're still coming in, and so I don't think that they made it to your packet. So 750, double-sided. This is what we've got, and I'll leave them with you. Each and every one of those comments is asking the Virginia Marine Resources Commission to look seriously at this issue and make a decision to deny the permit. And one of the main reasons why is because alternatives to building this project really do exist. We've heard a lot today so far about all of the research that's been done and how this is the only way that it can be done and that it's been exhaustive. Well, that's just not correct. Last year, the National Trust commissioned a report. We hired an electrical engineering firm out of Massachusetts, an independent one. They developed four different feasible alternatives, each of which would be cheaper to build, would meet the reliability needs, and also, and this is important for your jurisdiction, also, all four of these would require absolutely no crossing of the James River. When we submitted these to Dominion and to the Corps of Engineers last fall, we received a single cursory response letter from Dominion. We never got a formal response from the Corps. That is not a close look at alternatives. It was not done in a public and responsible and fully developed way. And that's unfortunate. And I'm also going to leave this report with you all here as well. We also heard a lot this morning about urgency, how we have to move very quickly on this, because if not, we may have cascading outages and the lights are going to go off. Well, that's also not true. Just earlier this month, on June 16th, the Department of Energy issued an order that allows Dominion to operate those Yorktown power plants as needed, if needed. They may not be needed, but if needed, to maintain electrical reliability on the peninsula. So there's not a risk of rolling blackouts. This has been done before. The Department of Energy has this authority just to ensure that we don't have the kinds of rolling blackouts that have been thrown up as a specter here today. These kinds of orders have been issued in other cases. Earlier, about 2006, in Alexandria City, there was a very, very similar issue where there was a standing DOE order that allowed a plant to run outside of environmental controls for several years while an additional power line was built. So there's precedent for this. Additionally, you heard a bit about the MATS rule, the Mercury Air Toxic Standards. Well, that's also a bit up in the air. That rule has been appealed. There's litigation ongoing in the United States District Court in District of Columbia. And that litigation challenges whether that rule will move forward, and it was actually put on hold on April 27th because the Trump administration has placed that rule under review. It's possible that the MATS rule will not exist in the future, and that is to be determined. In addition, the need for this project has changed. In the past just 6 months to a year, there have been two new proposed power plants in Charles City County. One, the C4GT plant, a 1,600 megawatt plant, actually completed all of its permitting on May 3rd, so it's going to begin construction soon. It's got an estimated time of online of 2020. There is another one that has been locally permitted but is still going through the SEC process, also in Charles City County, right near the existing Chickahominy Station. It's a 1650 megawatt station. So in the time while we have all been reviewing and all this federal and state review process that you heard about has been ongoing, things have changed, and they're going to continue to change. Additionally, you heard that there's no underground 500 kilovolt line anywhere in the country. Well, last year in Chino Hills, California, there was an approximately 4-mile, 500 kilovolt line that was finished and completed and energized. It was installed by horizontal directional drilling. So it is new technology, but it does exist. Mr. Curtis earlier said that Dominion's been working on this project since 2011. Well, it's 2017. The electrical grid has changed. Technology has changed and improved, but Dominion's approach has not. This is unfortunate because we're talking about some of the most significant historic resources that would be impacted in the United States. You're talking about, you know, you heard about 295 feet tall towers. That's, you know, that's about as tall as the Statue of Liberty, to give you a comparison. So even though it may be far from Jamestown Island, it may be a few miles from Colonial Parkway, when it's that tall and it's equipped with constantly flashing lights, you're not going to be able to miss it. And it's going to be a permanent intrusion in this historic landscape. Also wanted to speak briefly about the MOA that has been, or the Memorandum of Agreement that was mentioned, which was the mitigation agreement. it's true that the National Historic Preservation Act process has been completed, but it didn't resolve the harms that were identified. It's noteworthy that what's happened is Dominion agreed to pay for the harms that are going to be caused by this project. That's why there's a $85 million mitigation package attached to it. It's not that we avoided them. It's that we are paying, they're paying, to cause these harms. And not a single public interest organization, not the National Trust, not many of the other organizations that you're going to hear from today, none of the public interest organizations who've been involved in this have signed on to that agreement. It was only the state and federal regulators and one tribal group. So there's a good reason why nobody signed on to that, and it's because this project's not in the public interest. just to close out, I'll say that, you know, this is America's river. It's a resource of the Commonwealth, but the interest is national and international. And you have an opportunity to hold Dominion accountable here today. You can deny this permit, and you can send Dominion back to the drawing board. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions from the commission? Thank you, ma'am. Yes, please do. We will need to keep them, but don't expect us to read all of this in the next hour. Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
Good morning. My name is Jamie Bronco. I'm the Lower James River Keeper with the James River Association. It's a pleasure to be here this morning, and I appreciate the opportunity to share some comments. On behalf of the James River Association, our thousands of members and supporters, I'm here to speak in opposition to the Surrey Skiffs project. It's worth restating again and again, I think, that this is where America began. This is an important stretch of river. This is a place that's enjoyed by many, many members of our public for boating, fishing, kayaking, fishing, all of these great public uses. Our organization has been around for 41 years to really protect those interests for the public, but also to work on enhancing and restoring the health of the James River. The James has come a really long way if we look back 41 years. We've already talked a little bit about Keypone. We're seeing tremendous improvements. But in this particular stretch of river, if we look around the landscape, we can see that a lot of efforts have also taken place locally to preserve this section of river. I'm talking about easements. I'm talking about public parks. The Colonial Park, we have a national park. We have state agency-run lands. And these are all places where the public can access the river, where they can see the river, where they can go boating or fishing. From our perspective at the James River Association, these are fundamental experiences. These are how people understand the history, how they connect with the landscape, the narrative, all of the things that have taken place over the last 400 years that America has been existing along the banks of the James. So these are significant impacts. This is a large project. We've heard all about that. I don't need to say it again, but this is a large project that you cannot miss if you're a kayaker, if you're a boater on the river. So a little bit about some of the policies and some of the steps that have been taken. I already mentioned some of the lands that are being conserved. In 1988, the Virginia General Assembly named this area a state historic river. And this is important, I think. I'm going to give a little brief quote from the act. In keeping with the public policy of the Commonwealth to conserve portions of certain rivers possessing superior natural beauty, thereby assuring their use and enjoyment for their historic, scenic, recreational, geologic, fish and wildlife, culture, and other values. This section of the Lower James River from Lawns Creek to Upper Chipokes is hereby declared a historic river noteworthy of scenic and ecological qualities. And this is not simply a statement that we really like this stretch of river and we want to highlight it. It is celebrating that this is an important stretch of river, but it's also intended to provide guidelines for future development decisions. The General Assembly wanted agencies like VMRC to take this into consideration, that this area has been set aside as important for our cultural history, for our history as a nation, and so we should really consider that with every decision that's being made to develop the landscape. There are no bridges. There are no power lines in this stretch of river. You have to drive a ways upriver or downriver before you encounter one of these. There have been a lot of decisions made over the years to keep it this way. The U.S. Congress is also, it's worth noting that the U.S. Congress has designated this as America's founding river. Again, because of Jamestown, because of Williamsburg, because of all the history that we have here on the banks of the James. Now, a bit about sturgeon. Now, we've already heard a lot about the time of year restrictions and the potential impacts from the pilings and the poundings. This is an important place for sturgeon as well, and I agree that the time of year restriction will go a long way to easing those impacts and preventing some encounters from the construction process with sturgeon. But just in the last few years, really since this project has been considered, which started in 2012, believe it or not, we've learned a lot about sturgeon in this area. The James River Association has worked with a number of agencies, with a number of academic institutions to study the species. Since 2007, we've built habitat restoration projects in the upper James region for spawning sturgeon, and we now know that this part of the river, really between Deepwater Shoals and Hog Island, is a staging area for migratory sturgeon. There are two seasons. We didn't know that until the last few years. There's a fall season and there's a spring season. That's why we have this really, really limited time of year restriction where there's not sturgeon in the area. But beyond that, there are juveniles in the James year-round in this particular project area. So there will most certainly continue to be impacts, and those need to be carefully considered. We can do our best to try to minimize these impacts with the pounding, with the bubble curtains, but this is an important stretch of river for sturgeon. They are a prehistoric river, so we've got prehistoric species, and we've got historic resources right here congregated in a really important area, and this needs to be carefully considered as we move forward. Any impacts, any takes, that needs to be addressed up front, I think, by VMRC to make that clear to Dominion that cannot be allowed to happen. We cannot have a take of this endangered species. And one last thing I wanted to mention in terms of VMRC's role in this particular case. So VMRC has subaqueous guidelines that specifically refer to some things to consider with projects like this. So it does note in Section 1 of the guidelines that project alternatives should be considered, as well as the water dependency of each project. So alternatives, we've heard a lot about that. I'm not going to reiterate what Cherie said, but it's very hard to believe, I think, by just about everybody that there's only one practical option for a problem of getting power from one side of the river to the other. We're not talking about whether there is an option. We're talking about whether we're willing to compromise to meet the need of getting power to the peninsula while still protecting these resources. I'm confident there is a compromise. I'm confident that if you look back through the record, you'll see that there are a number of alternatives that will get that goal accomplished. Now, the second thing I want to mention is that the guidelines, Section 5, say specifically the state that the overhead crossings should be located at or near existing crossings. To be clear, I'm saying overhead crossings, projects that are being considered by VMRC, should be located at or near existing crossings. Just to say again, this is an area that has no development currently in the river. It's an area that is still very evocative of the time period when the colonists were first arriving in this section of river. So just to restate all this is a permanent adverse impact to the public. This is going to fundamentally alter the natural resources, but also the experiences that the public has when they visit this really important stretch of river. Impacting or diminishing the quality of these experiences is a cost that's going to be borne by the public. But this is a resource that really should be protected for all Virginians, for all members of the public to enjoy well into the future. I believe that the commission has authority to deny this permit. You have the backing of a number of concerned citizens that have been tracking this project for a number of years. I strongly urge you to deny the permit today so that we can protect the stretch of river, but also start to talk about a real compromise that'll get us to where we need to go and not harm these invaluable resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the commission? Thank you. Please come forward. Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
Good morning, and thank you. I'm Elizabeth Castelny. I'm the CEO of Preservation Virginia. Since 1889, our organization has been a voice for historic places. And I'd like to say personally, I was raised in Newport News, worked in Williamsburg, and now reside in Richmond, but I know this area very well. For 124 years, our organization has been the steward of 22 acres at historic Jamestown, where we have shared this historic site with the visiting public. 23 years ago, we undertook the Jamestown Rediscovery Project, which revealed the archaeological remains of the 1607 James Fort, and that has contributed to a deeper understanding of our nation's earliest beginnings. From that background, we know intimately what the impact of this project will be. Preservation Virginia is deeply concerned about the river's quality and its integrity. Other speakers have spoken more eloquently than I can about the harm to the sturgeon and fish populations, oyster beds, and scenic qualities. What I'd really like to concentrate is on the recreation and tourism. Gentlemen before spoke about how the peninsula sees itself as very much based on heritage or on tourism. Well, I'd like to define that further to heritage tourism. In 2017, the VCU Center of Urban and Regional Analysis with Preservation Virginia released an economic impact of heritage tourism in the Commonwealth. The study found heritage tourism is big business. Visitors annually spend more than $7.7 billion at heritage tourism sites. And heritage tourism sites spend an estimated $430 million. The total economic impact across the Commonwealth is $6.5 billion in additional economic activity, more than $640 million in state and local taxes, and an excess of $700 million in federal taxes. More than 105 jobs are created, and that doesn't count the indirect jobs of and the ripple effect of people at buying gas and food and those kinds of businesses that are support. Importantly, visitors are attracted to Virginia because of the authenticity of the experience. They enjoy historic downtowns, rural areas, and they enjoy our roadways and waterways for the integrity of that experience. The historic triangle is a center for heritage tourism, and the James River and the Colonial Parkway are focal points of that experience. The Captain John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail takes history and blends it with recreation and eco-tourism. The Colonial Parkway was designed in part to take advantage of the expansive views of the James River, the uninterrupted expansive views of the James River. Both of those experiences will be dramatically changed by this project. What has been largely preserved for 400 years will be impacted, as Sheree Williamson mentioned, with these structures that will be seen, because they not only will they be visible from a distance, but they will have blinking lights and other things that attract attention. That has the potential of affecting our economy going forward. Perhaps visitors may come the first time, but will they go home with the same word of mouth about the quality of their experience, about how they've been transported back in time to understand not only what happened here in Virginia 400 years ago and in the American Revolution and in these points of history, but how that still impacts our lives today? How does that go back to other communities across the nation about how Virginia's caring for its historic resources? Article 11 of the Virginia Constitution recognizes the importance of natural and historic sites in the Commonwealth. And the VMRC has the authority to act in the public interest to protect the James River. As Jamie Brunkow just mentioned, there are permitting guidelines that state that overhead crossings should be located at or near existing crossings in order to concentrate those interruptions in one area and preserving these nearly pristine areas for future generations. You've heard there are alternatives to building this overhead transmission line across the James River. And this is a decision that will affect Virginians for the next 100 years. It's not just about the construction and the impact during that period, but it's for 100 years as this transmission line dominates that landscape. This will be the legacy. We respectfully ask that you require the permit applicant to provide more information and independent analysis of alternatives and deny this permit that would do irreparable harm to the James River. Thank you on behalf of Preservation Virginia's members across the Commonwealth and across the nation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is there any other spokesperson? Please come forward, sir. You hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
My name's Edward Chappell. I live in Williamsburg. For 36 years, I was director of architectural research and preservation at Colonial Williamsburg, and for the last decade, also director of archaeological research. This may be one of the most important decisions you'll ever make about the future of Virginia. The James River Power Line Crossing and its 17 steel towers should be considered in terms of a point of priority. Surely there's some areas of this country worth preserving, some pristine sites worth saving. There's no area of the country more worthy of preserving than this. You have the authority to act in the public interest. It's not in the public interest to approve this proposal. If you don't protect this part of Virginia, what will you protect? What's left? What's more important? What's even equally important? The negative impact on the crucial scenic part of the James River would be hugely destructive, especially from the river itself. I've long loved this amazing view of the river from the Colonial Parkway, in some ways the most evocative point along the Colonial Parkway. But when I actually went out onto the river to the point where the crossing would be, it had an extraordinary impact on me. I encourage you to do the same. Just downriver from Jamestown, the crossing would be clearly visible to the open, unspoiled part of the parkway. It would spoil the view from Carter's Grove and Wolfston hometown, and it would affect Jamestown. This is the most crucial segment of the Captain John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail. The immediate water approach to Jamestown. In an area of incomparably rich archaeological resources, this project will indirectly affect development spawned by this development that will affect countless archaeological resources. It's a part of the James crucial to the Atlantic sturgeon, as Jamie just spoke, about which we're just now learning. How the sturgeon interact with this particular deep piece of the James River and to other maritime life. Millions of citizens enjoy this core piece of the river, and it has a huge impact on the Virginia economy. There are better solutions, alternatives to soiling the nest of America. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any other spokespersons? Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
Yes, I do.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Bonnie Hoffmeyer. I'm the executive director for the Jamestown Society, and I'm also a resident of Charles City County. And I thank you for the opportunity to be able to speak to you today. On behalf of the members and the board of directors of the Jamestown Society, I express our deepest concern for the proposed project regarding Dominion Virginia Power's transmission line across the James River. Our nonprofit is focused on preserving our nation's early history. We are devoted to the preservation and the archaeological excavations which take place at Jamestown. These digs have been bringing international recognition to the fort with its findings of the earliest years of our country. And these findings have increased visitation to the fort and imagining what life was like for those early colonists, which is something it's relatively easy to do with the same vistas for basically 400 years. We are mostly concerned with the negative scarring of our mostly undisturbed view sheds along the lower James River, and we urge you to consider what the alternatives are to building an overhead transmission line of these 17 towers. As a lifelong resident of the James River, I have spent my life swimming, boating, and fishing and enjoying these vistas. My children have enjoyed these opportunities, as I'm sure many other residents and multitudes of tourists who come into the area. I know one of you asked how far the towers would be from Jamestown, and I believe the answer was 4 miles. I live 6 miles down from Jamestown and can easily see the ferry crossing, and that's much smaller than these towers will be. I hope you also agree on the importance of preserving the James River for the future generations, and we hope you will deny Dominion Virginia Power's request. Thank you.
Thanks, ma'am. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, up you got?
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Margaret Fowler. I'm one of the founders of Save the James Alliance. And my comments are a little unprepared, so I won't keep you long, but I've heard a couple things that need clarification. First of all, we haven't said it here today, but it's important that we say it. I think I speak on behalf of everyone in opposition. We all want reliable power. This isn't about making that choice. We do believe the alternatives provide an alternative that gets us to both places and cost effectively. We hear Dominion talk about cost. The cost they look at is the cost to their bottom line, and that's the only cost that's weighed. It's important to note that while this project was started in 2011, if you'll read their integrated resources plan from 2011, this is a pure business decision. This isn't about reliable power. This is about aligning their assets to achieve a profitable bottom line. Now, let's hand them that. That's what they're in business for. That's what they do. But it comes, in this instance, with the sacrifice of America's birthplace. In their 2011 integrated resource plan, they lay out clearly plans at that time. The IRP, as it called, goes 5 years in, year by year. In 2011, the expectation was actually that Yorktown would stay open into the 2020s. And the expectation was, in fact, that they would run gas and burn natural gas for one of the burners at Yorktown. And that's still possible. Gas runs to Yorktown Power Station today. They are burning gas at Yorktown today. The cost to convert the BRIMO plant was only about $84 million. They can do that at Yorktown today. And they can get it done to 10 and 11 months. So there are alternatives. But importantly, even if Yorktown does nothing more than supply them for peak power, which is what their permit permits them to do now, to run it just in peak instances when they really need it, our plan all along was not that it be the permanent solution, but that it provide an option for us to all go back to the drawing board and look for more permanent solutions, because we're right on the cusp of 21st century technology. Their technology is 19th and 20th century technology, and we're right on the precipice of change. So why build towers that are going to be in the river 100 years? The other thing that's important to note, someone noted in reference Surrey Power Station as the source of the power. That's not the case. In fact, if you'll read their application to the State Corporation Commission for their Brunswick County plant and for their Greensville County plant, both natural gas plants, which were built specifically to feed off eventually the Atlantic Coast Pipeline project, which is another controversial project they have in the books. Excuse me. You will know that the power that they took off the peninsula is coming from the Brunswick County plant and the Greensville plant. And that all that's happening at Surrey is that they're aggregating the power there in a switching yard. And they'll aggregate the power to 500 kilovolt, bring it across that 4 miles of river, and then break it down to 230. It's going to be 500 kilovolts only for that span over the river. Why? There are alternatives here, and Ms. Williamson referenced a study. She gave you a copy of it. That's done by a team at MIT who showed multiple ways to do this, multiple ways to do it cost-effectively. And just because the SEC didn't hear that, the SEC hearing was 5 years ago. A lot has happened since then. So while we have struggled with the Army Corps of Engineers and this constant reference to the SEC approval was a long time ago. The technology's changed. The world has changed. And I ask you all to be the final guard here to help us stop and review what's new today, not what was old 5 years ago. Thank you so much for your time. I do hope that you'll vote against this.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Please come forward. Do you hereby swear the testimony you give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Dorothy Cantor. And I, to give you a little background on who I am, I have a bachelor's degree in mathematics and a PhD in biophysics, and I worked for EPA for 15 years, first in the, always in the hazardous waste program, and my last gig before retiring was the anthrax cleanups, where I provided scientific oversight. I am a member of the National Parks Conservation Association. I am not a member of the staff, though. I've been on the board, and I've been a volunteer for 29 years. And I am a national parks fanatic. I've been to over 270 of the national park units. And in my opinion, Colonial National Historical Park, of which Jamestown and Yorktown and the Colonial Parkway are a part, is the most important of the cultural historical parks in this nation. You've heard that this is where it all began. This is where the first English colonists landed. This is where the first slaves were brought in to the British colonies. And I want to also say that you all have a difficult decision, and I appreciate all the constraints on you and all the different forces that are pulling at you. So good luck. You've heard so many reasons why this project should not be done, including the fact that it started so long ago and there have been changes in technology, there have been changes in population density, there have been changes that could have impacted enormously. I would like to bring up two other points that have not been made, I do not believe. First of all, the Army Corps of Engineers did not require an environmental impact statement. This is a very enormous project. They went with an environmental assessment. Oh, I was told to tell you that National Park Conservation Association has 1.2 million members and supporters, and 23,000 of them live in Virginia. So back to the environmental impact statement. They did not require it. I would like to give you a contra example. There was an existing power line on the Delaware River and part of the Delaware River National Recreational Area, another national park unit, not nearly as significant, not nearly as historic. This power line went over the river, and there was a request to build a bigger power line in the same footprint of that power line. And an environmental impact statement was required, was performed there. They did allow the power line to proceed, but they did do this important first step. And environmental impact statements also go into what the alternatives are. And that wasn't done here. It needs to be done, okay? And that will get to something I can say that might be an alternative for what you can decide here. Secondly, I would like to tell you that over 30 national, local, and regional organizations, conservation organizations, have come out either totally against the project or requesting that the environmental impact statement be performed. This was before the Army Corps of Engineers made its decision. There are organizations that include Scenic America, the Garden Club of America, not just Virginia, the entire United States, American Rivers. You know about National Parks Conservation Association. You know about the National Trust for Historic Preservation. There are organizations from Texas all the way to New Jersey who have come out against it. The New Jersey one is the Hamilton one for the manufacture of manufacturing. So, and you've heard it that there'll be towers as tall as the Statue of Liberty, which, by the way, is also a national park. In the middle of the James River, in the middle of a very scenic, beautiful, undisturbed spot, a place that people can go to for solace, from grief, for happiness, and it'll be just totally disturbed. To give you an example of the horrendous visual effects, you just need to go a few blocks away from here, a mile from here, to the James River Bridge. That's an already degraded area, and there is a power line next to that bridge, not nearly as high as the one that will go over this beautiful spot. And you can take a look at that and make a judgment for yourself what it looks like and what its impacts would be on the main James River. And you did hear that the Captain John Smith National Historic Trail, also a part of the National Park System, is going to be very adversely affected. So I would like to say that, of course, I would like you to deny the permit. But I know there are a lot of conflicting forces. And I would say that if you cannot bring yourself to do that, one thing that you could do is go back to the Army Corps of Engineers and say you need to get a really full, complete, scientific, analytical evaluation of the new alternatives. Dominion answered in a very haughty way and said, none of these will work. They did not provide their analysis. They didn't have the courtesy. They didn't to do that. So I think that please either reject it or else please go back to the Army Corps of Engineers and say we need a full analysis of the new alternative. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Anyone else who's going to act as a spokesperson? Yes, sir? Are you going to act as a spokesperson?
Yes, ma'am.
Please come forward. Please raise your right hand. Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth to help you, God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Joseph McCauley, and I'm here representing the Chesapeake Conservancy. Okay. I thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. My experience with this board is that you take your responsibilities to protect the waters of the Commonwealth and its many aquatic resources very seriously, and we appreciate that very much. One of the primary components of the Chesapeake Conservancy's mission is to support, advocate for the Captain John Smith Chesapeake National Historic Trail, Chesapeake Trail for short. The Chesapeake Trail is really a relatively new unit of the National Park Service. It just celebrated its 10th anniversary recently, and the first few years after the trail was approved by Congress involved a lot of planning, coordinating with tribes and other partners to identify, in part, the most evocative, important sites along the trail where the story of the early exploration of this country and the interaction with American Indian tribes can be best told. There's one place that really needs no further investigation to understand its critical importance in that regard, and that's the Jamestown. These towers, the construction of these 17 towers across the James River will irreparably harm the view from Jamestown and therefore the trail itself. This trail has unmet potential. Being so new, I really think that over time, if interpreted and promoted properly, could be a huge economic benefit to the region, as are many of our other park units. So we definitely respectfully ask you to deny this permit. And we've heard a lot about alternatives today, and like others, I've learned something today, listening to the testimony from VIMS, what I heard was that the research on some of the methodologies proposed here is relatively new, and there are really no peer-reviewed research papers on it that VIMS used, you know, found what they could, industry-produced research. And based on that limited review of non-peer-reviewed papers, they still came up with some common sense time of year restrictions that would protect aquatic resources in the James River, including a very vulnerable species, the Atlantic sturgeon, and a very economically, socially, and ecologically important species, the oyster. So a lot of effort is being put into conserving these species. We have some very common sense time of year restrictions, but Dominion says if they have to abide by those, the project is no longer feasible. So to me, that alone suggests a review, a further review of alternatives. We've heard testimony this morning that there are alternatives out there that have been looked at and could provide the reliable energy that we all need and support. So I think it's time to take a step back. I would encourage you to deny this permit and give time for the parties to come to a solution that does not impact our national treasures and still delivers the power that's needed. So I encourage you to deny the permit. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Anyone acting as a spokesperson?
Yes.
Please. Do you hereby swear the testimony you give here today will be the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth, help you God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record.
My name is Leighton Powell, and I'm the executive director of Scenic Virginia. Mm-hmm. And all of my comments have already been stated, so I'm not going to restate them here. But I do want to press the point that this environmental impact statement was not done, and it really is your way to let to make sure that these other things are looked at. This is such a special place. You all know this. And if you can't deny the permit, please consider doing that. It to me, it's the way to go. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Any other spokespersons? Let me ask this. Is there anybody in the audience who wants to testify about an aspect that we have not heard about? Anything new you want to bring up to the board that's on point? Okay. That said, we are now going to move into the lightning round. Want to testify? Come on up. Make it brief. We don't need to hear the same thing again and again and again and again and again and be repetitive and redundant and repetitive and redundant. So, who wants to be first? Mr. Beck.
These comments...
I have to swear you in, Mr. Beck.
Okay.
Do you hereby swear the testimony you'll give here today will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Please state your name for the record, Mr. Beck.
Robert G. Beck. I live in Williamsburg. These comments I was going to give each of you, but they've all been said somewhat. I just have a few brief comments. I'm disappointed that the staff... recommends that approval. The Corps of Engineers, they're really not concerned about what you all are concerned about, and the water, the seafood industry, and what it means to us in Virginia. The State Corporation Commission doesn't care about that either, in my book, for what we want here. Briefly, I sent you all some time ago a photograph of a mini storage company I built in Chesapeake. Their power lines were over two of my buildings. Those power lines dripped, rust, whatever, and the roofs are in bad shape. The rest of the mini storage is clean. The roofs are clean. So I worry about the rust dripping off of these wires. Maybe insignificant, but it will happen, and it'll dump rust in the James River, which should concern you all pertaining to seafood and so forth. Crabs don't want it. Oysters don't want it. You know, fish don't want it. So that's something to really think about, what it's going to do to the impact in the river. Um, You know, one other main thing that hasn't been mentioned is just yesterday, Germany announced they're going to do away with half of their nuclear power plants. In a newspaper recently, they two countries out, South Korea, I think, is one of them, Japan's one of them, they're going to do away with nuclear plants. I think that the day is coming when Surrey will be shut down. I don't know when, but the day will come, and I don't think the power lines will be any good then, so that's something else to think about. And the, let's see, oh, I think Dominion Power ought to concentrate, and this has not been said, or maybe briefly, I think Dominion Power ought to concentrate on solar and wind. You ride down through North Carolina, and field after field, you see these beautiful solar things. What we need is clean energy, and I think that is where we should go. And I think we should forget about putting power line across the river. I hope you all will turn it down. You know, I sat up there with you all a couple years ago, and I remember when we tried to put when a developer wanted to build a marina in the Rappahannock, we turned it down because of the pilings and so forth and what it would do to the seafood and the wildlife. We turned down a walk with pilings in front of King's Mill, and here they want to put 600 pilings in the James River. Thank you for letting me testify today.
Thank you, Mr. Beck, and thank you for your service here as an associate commissioner for those years. You served with great distinction. Thank you, sir. You hereby swear the testimony you give here today will be the truth, whole truth, and nothing but the truth's help you got?
Yes.
See, even my swearing you in here is going into lightning round.
I'm Pamela Goddard with the National Parks Conservation Association, and I'm not going to repeat a lot of things that have been said already, but there are a couple things that came up that I need to remark on. When we were established by the very first Park Service Director almost 100 years ago to protect and preserve the national parks, and we work not only on the parks themselves, but the air and water that go through them and around them, and the iconic species that live in them and nearby, like the elk at Yellowstone or the moose at Acadia, and definitely the sturgeon at Jamestown. So I was very troubled today to hear debates about time of year restrictions and maybe changing some of those time of year restrictions. The National Marine Fisheries Service a year ago designated draft critical habitat for the Atlantic sturgeon, starting at Bosher Dam, going all the way to the mouth of the bay. And that critical habitat designation should be finalized sometime in July. Now, we know if this project went forward, there'll be impacts to the sturgeon. And the time of year restrictions will help during spawning season, but will do nothing for the juveniles. And as Mr. Bronco testified, those animals live in the James River till they're 10, 15 years old. So I would urge you to please not have stronger time of year restrictions, if not less, but please don't go backwards on any time of year restrictions. The other thing that troubles me is that whenever we are working on any type of project, we reach out to the other side. And almost 5 years ago, we invited Bob Blue and other members of Dominion to go out on a boat with us and go down the James River and said, how can we find a solution? You have a company to run, and you want to make money, and you want to provide power. We want to protect the park. And it's troubling to me that all these years later, their plan has not changed. And that tells me they don't want to change their plan. They're not open to alternatives. And National Parks Conservation Association and the National Trust all hired outside contractors to look at this issue, and they came up with many alternatives. I would urge you to, I know this is a tough day for you all, but the stakes are very, very high. This decision will last forever, and there'll be a blinking tall reminder every single day if the decision goes the way we hope it does not. So I urge you to think about the weight of what you're facing. There are alternatives. We know there are. And we urge you to vote no.
Thank you, ma'am. Anyone else in the lightning round? Oh, come on. I know you want to. No other public testimony in the public hearing portion. Okay. Dominion. Want to take a few minutes to rebut and wrap up, please?
Thank you, Commissioner. I appreciate that. This certainly is a complex decision. It's very important. There are definitely some things I'd like to tick off in the lightning perspective. Number one, the Chino Hills reference is 500 kV, a completely different technology. It's what we call XLPE, cross-link polyethylene cable, not the type to be suitable for a river crossing unless we put it in some kind of tunnel, so to speak. So that's not a viable option looking at that installation. The plants at Charles City County, they're on the wrong end of the peninsula. If those plants being discussed for Charles City County were in the vicinity of Yorktown, then that would be sufficient. But being up in the Charles City County area, that's not providing the flow in the place that you need it. You need to inject the flow down and further down into the peninsula to support the customers there and to alleviate the transmission concerns. The DOE extension, that's a 90-day temporary extension that was granted because of the critical nature of the reliability on the peninsula. It is not a long-term solution. And to think that we can indefinitely ask for 90-day extensions to solve the problem is not acceptable. That you get the 90 days at a time, and it's to bridge a gap until the project's complete, not be a solution for long term. The Tabor's alternatives, I feel like we've been very fair at looking at other alternatives that have been proposed. These models are very complex. It's easy to talk about a solution on one hand, but to run the models and ensure that it's going to work for the Commonwealth for the long run is a different story. We reviewed those, and to be fair and to make sure that it's getting a consistent evaluation, PJM, that I mentioned earlier, that's the operator in the Mid-Atlantic transmission grid, also reviewed all those alternatives and said they were not acceptable to solve the problem at hand. So it's not just Dominion reviewing those, saying those aren't acceptable. We've gone to PJM, who's an expert for multiple states. The reference to gas at Yorktown has come up several times. There's a limited amount of gas at Yorktown to help co-fire the old oil unit. It's not adequate if you want to power an entire facility and convert it over to 100% gas. You need a new pipeline with larger, more capacity. So I just want to make sure that we're clear on that. And I guess I just want to make sure that the commission appreciates this. This is one of the most significant reliability issues that we have ever faced in the Commonwealth of Virginia. I've talked about being in the operating center and understanding how the transmission grid operates. There's no doubt in my mind that this is one of the most significant reliability situations we've faced. The DOE extension does not eliminate the potential for blackouts. The reference that Mr. Stagg made to a remedial action scheme, that's a scheme that would shed three-fourths of the load on the peninsula if we sense that the transmission grid is starting to suffer under certain contingency situations. Granted, the 90-day extension helps reduce that exposure, but you're talking about two coal-fired units that are nearing end of life, and while they're running and available, and they were called on 23 times last summer to maintain reliability and avoid the kind of situation we're talking about, that's not the long-term solution that you want to be in. And I guess the last thing I'd like to say is staying the course on this project is not because we were being resistant to considering new alternatives. We've continued to look at options. The fact that we are here 6 years later and are still pressing forward with something we strongly believe in, I think, is a testament to that it is a legitimate solution. It's been vetted by other entities. We've looked at revisions to load forecast, all these other alternatives that we've talked about, continue to come up with the same answer for the long run. Connecting that line to the switchyard at Surrey taps into a bigger network of generation. That's what provides the reliability for the peninsula. And other interim or piecemeal solutions just don't give us and our customers what we need. And it's not about Dominion's bottom line. If we're worried about Dominion's bottom line, we can find the most expensive project and earn a return on the asset. It's about the cost to customers for reliable service. And that's why this project has stayed in the forefront of being the most appropriate and attractive solution that's least impactful.
Thank you. Mr. Zedrin.
Could you comment a little bit? Somebody was talking about like wind energy and solar energy. Can you comment about that and why that wasn't a viable option?
We did look at it. We're talking, and I'll have to use some math to kind of give scope and scale. Generation at Yorktown that we need for the long run to address reliability is on the order of 600 megawatts. And we need that available anytime that we can get it. Solar is not available all the time. It's not available at night. So we still need generation on the peninsula to provide for load at night. The other complicating factor is solar takes about 8 to 10 acres per megawatt. So if we need 600 megawatts, and we need it round the clock, which is a limitation for solar, the land mass, the amount of space you need in the vicinity of Yorktown, in the middle part of the peninsula, it's just not a viable option to give you that energy when you need it. Are we doing solar on Dominion Energy System? Absolutely. We talk about that in our IRP that was referenced. And holistically looking at solar as part of a portfolio of energy that provides service to all customers is one thing. Using that to target a reliability solution in a geographically isolated area that you need around the clock just doesn't make solar by itself feasible. You still need traditional generation, conventional generation.
Mr. Packard.
Can you tell us about the long-term plans for Surrey and how long that facility can be operational?
Yes. Right now it's operational through the late 2030s. And we are also intending to most likely ask for a permit extension that would add another 20 years to that, late 2050s or 2060. And you know, I want to emphasize a point again. Surrey could retire tomorrow, and the switchyard at Surrey is still the best place to put this transmission line and connect it because the 500 grid is connected to these other units that have been mentioned. So the Brunswick, the Greensville, the Warren, that 500 grid is the efficient pathway. It's the HOV lane, so to speak, of access to all that generation. So it's the fact that the Surrey switchyard is a great connection point is to allow for Surrey to serve the greater grid. But if Surrey wasn't present, the best place for the line and the best connection is still the Surrey switchyard because of this 500,000 volt interconnection that's tied directly into our other units.
Any other questions from the commission?
One more.
Mr. Packard.
The long-term strategy for energy. I mean, if there's one thing that we know in this world today is change is growing at a faster rate. I mean, are we really looking at a strategy that's a 2011, 19th, or 20th century strategy and not a 21st century strategy here?
I think the solution, whether it was 5 years ago or today, is the right answer. It would be the same solution if we were starting from scratch. A lot of what we're seeing with technology changes is around generation, and we are seeing more solar, more renewables. As the price comes down, it makes it more applicable. I think you will still need transmission lines. You'll still need a reliable backbone. And if you look across the country, there have been significant investments in the transmission grid for technology to advance the ability to use more renewables and have access and keep the grid reliable. The transmission to me is still the 21st century solution when it's packaged with the other alternatives, generation source.
Any other questions from the commission? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much for your time.
Well, either by dumb luck or good management, I think it's mostly dumb luck. That my math count, my minutes count here shows that the applicant and their supporters have taken 52 minutes and the protestants have taken 55 minutes. I think we've gotten pretty close in a fair and equitable balanced type of public hearing. Before I close the public hearing, is there anybody else that has a burning thought that you really need the commission to hear? Seeing none, the public hearing is closed. The matter is now before the commission for discussion and action. Let's have a discussion.
I have a question for Ben.
Okay, Mr. Neal.
and I'm not sure Ben can even answer this question. So the time limit on this thing is by the Army Corps. Their permit says they have to have this completed about this time in 2020, June 20th, 2020, something like that, June 12th. No, do you know the rationale on that? And we're talking less than 3 years now.
No, I can't answer that question.
I didn't think you could.
Hey, Ben, let's speak up a little.
I cannot answer that question. I don't think anyone from the Corps is here.
Mr. Erskine.
I want to thank staff for their due diligence on this project and thank the public for all the comments that they've made. Clearly, it's an important issue, and I think it's important to this commission as well. I do have a specific question for Mr. Stagg, and I don't know if you have in your presentation depiction of the public oyster grounds that are in this area.
Since the protests were resolved, I don't, but I can put a map up and get you close.
But as I understand, those were the two private leaseholders that were directly impacted. I guess I was interested in the location of the public oyster ground in relation to this proposed transmission line.
The closest public ground is down to the south here, below Skips Creek area, this area. So this is pretty far away from any of the public ground. No direct impact, obviously, to public ground.
Right. As a follow-up, are these productive oyster grounds?
Leases?
I'm talking about the public fishery at this point. To give the commission an idea, how close are we to, I realize it's not on top of it, it's no direct impact, but we haven't really heard there is not going to be impact to future oyster recruitment in this area. Nobody can really give us that definitive answer. So my concern is the productivity in this river for the public oyster ground. We need to have, I think, on this board a clear distinction of our responsibility to that resource in the area.
Andrew, address the public ground. As far as the private leases in this area, there is some activity this far north. The issue you have here for private leases, and he may reiterate this on some of the northern part of the public ground, is that you do get strike here on occasion, but you get a lot of freshets here that negate that quite often. They kill a lot of the oysters when we have a really freshwater events. So the James River is very productive river, but more productive to the south and considerably to the south. But I'll let Andrew address the public ground issues.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Button, did I swear you in earlier today?
Yes.
Great. Please proceed.
So this is sort of probably the uppermost range of where you'd get a traditional strike where the oysters would live there. So in terms of the direct impact, it would be minimal, but sort of the indirect unknown. I don't have a definitive answer on that, but it's sort of on the upper range of where we traditionally see that wild strike. And as Ben stated there is often a freshet where some of those oysters would generally not live if there was sort of extended freshwater periods there. So not a definitive answer you're looking for, but yeah, it's sort of the upper range. And this is where we did have the shell dredge working there, the tribal shoals area, but sort of historically most of the activity is downstream there.
Thank you.
Mr. Frantz.
Yeah, I have a question for Mr. Button, and you just touched on that subject. Will this interfere or any way interfere with possible fossil shell reserves?
There are still some limited fossil shell reserves, but most of the activity that we've shifted to is downstream of there in the new dredge site. So most of these areas, we've gotten the majority of what's easy to get up there. So there's still a little bit left. So the potential that I don't think the actual power lines would restrict our ability to get up there if we did want to look back into those sites. I think we'd still be able to get under them.
Thank you.
Other questions from the commission? Other discussions from the commission?
I'll just add that the sites that have been mined in that area would not, I don't think any of the ones we've used in the past, they may still have some shale resource left or really in the alignment of any of these towers.
Thank you, gentlemen. Let me ask a question at Dominion. You guys have a chance to talk about time of year restrictions?
Yes, sir, we did. Anything you could do, we would be very grateful for. Some consideration for the later 2 months, being sensitive to the herring concerns in the mid-February and March time frame. If you're willing to do two and two, I mean, we certainly, any additional time.
Spell it out for the board.
So if the current restrictions, I understand it, from February to June is February 15th to June 15th.
Correct.
Well, little bit I know, and there are folks here that will obviously there's a concern for herring and the activities starting in February. So if we were going to pick, let's say if there was even a consideration for discussion on time. You know, is it the first month, last month, 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there? I mean, you'd rather have the time contiguous so that it adds to construction efficiency. And it sounds like if there is a preference, it's the early part of that four-month window versus the latter part of that four-month window. So if you're asking, is there some compromise, certainly. Instead of 4 months, it was 2 months. We would recognize and respect that first 2 months of that period of time and then work respectively from the April 15th.
Would that still be a one-tower-at-a-time construction time frame, or would you look at two, or would you ask for two?
I was going to make sure I'm answering right, looking at the project manager. It'd still be the same. We have two rigs.
Correct.
Driving one pile at a time.
All right. Okay.
We appreciate the consideration.
That's an option for the board to consider.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the looking into that. I appreciate the discussions you all held on that. So, Ben, would you please spark the commission's discussion by going over the staff recommendation one more time?
Correct and true. I apologize for having the same condition there twice at the beginning. I don't know how that happened. Late night working on this, I guess. But our recommendations, we do recommend approval of the project with the conditions that they use bubble curtains on all tower and fender pile driving activity. They use cushion box associated with the pile driving. They use isolation chambers for all pile driving to enhance effectiveness of the required bubble curtains. We do recommend a time of year restriction from February 15th through June 15th of any year, and that they only limit pile driving to one tower at a time. The floor permit has another restriction related to the deep water, which we don't need to repeat in ours. So they are restricted, though, from doing the five deep water towers by the core permit. They have to do that work between November 15th and February 14th, November 16th. February
14th. All right, I'll start the ball. I want to thank everybody. And this has been an intelligent and informed discussion. I appreciate very much the passion that has gone into this. I appreciate the brevity as well. This is the protestants are correct. This is a very important decision. It's going to be the most important decision we've ever made here or ever will. I don't know about that, but this is something that is something that we take very seriously, and we are cognizant, I'm sure all of us are cognizant, about the importance of this decision. Tell you my perspective is this. This has been studied at the SEC level. This has been decided at the SEC level that this transmission location and construction methodology, that's what they decided. Wasn't made in a vacuum. They spent a lot of time on that decision. The Army Corps of Engineers, and actually it survived the Virginia State Supreme Court review. The Army Corps of Engineers looked at the same thing, decided the same route with the same construction activities. They decided on that this was an appropriate use, and this was an appropriate policy and appropriate decision. And they did that after 3 years of examination. We may all agree with how they did it or how they didn't do it, but the fact is, from my perspective here, is that I am reluctant to superimpose my judgment here and now on the decisions that were made by those entities in their jurisdictions after years of study and a decision. So I personally, whatever I personally feel about where this is going or that it's going, I believe that my charge, my responsibility rests on our jurisdictional impacts onto the water bottom. And I appreciate everybody's perspective here, but I am personally reluctant to superimpose my or negate everyone else's decisions based on my personal belief, whatever that might be, and I'm not saying what it is. So, to that end, for me, the question is the appropriate way to have these towers constructed in the water bottom and the appropriate way in which to reduce and to minimize the impact to our water bottoms and our fisheries. That's my perspective, and I'm not sure everybody agrees with that. So to that end, I'm inclined to support the staff recommendation, but I'm also inclined to kind of perhaps have a discussion about tinkering with the time of year restriction. So I've laid my cards on the table. Anybody else? Mr. Zedrin.
You know, it's kind of, I didn't even know this was coming up until I got my packet today. I'm not today, but this week. It's kind of strange. My son called me earlier this week, and he lives in a house, and he's got a freezer. And he told me, he says, you know, something happened with electricity last night, and I don't know whether it was a transformer or whatever, but, you know, when I got up this morning, the freezer, all my seafood and steaks and things in the freezer are bad because they had no electricity. And so I think that a lot of times we take for granted electricity and power and things like that. And today, you know, there's no hardships. You got air conditioning, you got heat, you got this, you got that. And just assume it's always going to be there. And I echo what the commissioner said here. I mean, you look at all these agencies that looked into this thing. I mean, it's been an uphill battle for Dominion Power to meet everybody's requirements. And I'll be the first to tell you that I don't know anything about all these particular different agencies. Every one of them are like specialists in their field. And also, I'm a big hunter. I'm a charter captain. I love the outdoors. You know, love the water. And understand what the people are saying here about how beautiful water is and everything, because that's me. I'm out there. But at the same time, you know, I turn my air conditioner on to my house. And so I understand what power is all about. And I think that that I'm going to have to rely on what these other agencies did. And it wasn't one agency. It was time and time and time again. And it's taken a long time. So I think they've jumped through the hoops and made some modifications where there was necessary. And I don't want to take and put my decision process and override these other agencies that specialize in doing what they do great. And this memorandum of understanding or agreement, you know, they tried to take and meet the request of the Historic Society and the preservation and you know, and we learned a whole lot about pile driving and how it affects the species of fish in the water. And so, but they've all adapted to what we're going to do to minimize all this stuff. So I'm going to have to go along with the commissioner here and say, look, you know, I think we need to look at all these other agencies, their review. There's been years of review, went to the Supreme Court and back, and that's another aspect we don't normally see in a case like this. But I think I'm going to support the same way the commissioner is.
Can I ask
Mr. Neal?
Vims for some input?
Absolutely.
So that's you.
Mr. Varnell?
We've these steel pilings, we've addressed this before, and I recall herring was a real concern with the acoustic problems, messing them up. We've got herring, I guess shad, striped bass, we've heard sturgeon. In this area of the river, I guess all those species are of concern, I would.
Those plus the residents in the in our packet we provided earlier on a different project, a list of about 60, I think, near the mouth of Chucktuck Creek for a different project.
Right.
Still, yeah, still pilings. Now, some of those species in that list, windowpane, maybe black sea bass. In a drought year, they can make it up to this area, but they're, but they have been found in this area. So it's a multiple species that we thought that you needed to be aware of that undergo reproduction. Maybe not migration because they're more residents, but some do. But there's a reproduction in the nursery area in this part of the river during those times also for the anadromous fish. But yes, the anadromous fish are of course a concern.
Okay, in this time of year closure, and I'm sure you're not going to want to say any of this is not important, but my question would be, what is the most critical time for the construction closure?
Well, this has come up numerous times throughout my career at fisheries here at BMRC from the 80s and going on to VIMS handling these things. And it has been a part of our conversations at VIMS. It's been a part of our conversations at VIMS with this also. You know, when we look at this, what are some alternatives that we can provide? It would be beneficial to all of us if the environment and the ecologies anywhere in the bay were more predictable. We really can't give you a very confident window to say this is more important than this, because the migration of anadromous fish, as many know, is temperature, salinity, other things that depend on it. It's a very complex mix. And that could happen early, that can happen later. And I don't want to confuse the issue, Dr. Neal, more than it is, but we've actually had conversations at VIMS now with the warming of the ocean in the bay. Are these traditional window dates still appropriate? And we can't even answer that yet. So as of, if you're getting to where would it be most appropriate to relax the restriction, you're going to reduce the you're going to increase the likelihood of impact, because it's known that from data those windows were set from empirical data in traditionally. So we know that that's a window that you can be confident that fish have used in the past, sometimes outside of those depending upon other things. So our discussions at VIMS, and I wish Dr. Tuckey was here today. He couldn't make it. He's actually with ASMFC, Eel Technical Committee, doing further work for the Commonwealth in that respect. Him and others, and when we've had this, not just for this project but others, it's very difficult to try to give you some solid, confident guidance on the first part or the last part or somewhere in the middle.
Mr. Packard.
The steel piling part, Lyle, this is something that is perhaps a greater danger to the fish in the area. Is that correct, though? Is there something greater going on here than which we're used to with regard to steel piling?
With this project and with what is proposed, that is the focus of what our concern is. General construction, that's happening as we speak somewhere in the bay, and we understand all of that. But the hollow steel piles are the primary focus of all of our concern here. And to get to, I guess, Mr. Erskine's concerns about the oyster grounds, there's some work in the Hudson River that shows there are various levels. The level of direct mortality and effects to physiology and such to a nekton, which is mostly fish, of course, that's been focused on, is right over 200 decibels. And where it affects behavior is right over 180 decibels. In the Hudson River, that has been shown to go, even with some of the BMPs, a few thousand feet or hundreds of feet cumulatively over strikes. Now, those are larger piles up there, but that's just a scale that we have to show you and demonstrate to you that I shared with the staff here, Ben and others here. to why we have this large concern. Now, the BMPs, the measures that we have recommended are additive. That's what the literature says. So if you incorporate all of those, you continue to have an additive reduction of effect from a distance perspective. So given the boundaries of what we're looking at from this project and knowing that that's the product of choice, we've provided you with everything we know that can reduce, and we can't say that it eliminates, but it reduces. And there are other concerns. I mean, you know, some of these pilings we know are driven at an angle. The sleeve will go to reduce some of that effect. But bubbles, they obey gravity. So that's not going to go, they're not going to go up at an angle. So there's still a little bit there, but that's just the realities we have to deal with this project. So I guess we have no further concerns other than the effects of driving the hollow steel piles for this project.
Ms. Lusk?
Yes, thank you. And thanks to everyone that has spoken today. I am new to this board and new to this issue. And so I came in today without sort of, my mind was a clean slate. And I don't disagree with what's been said by the commissioner and other people on this board about the fact that this project has been considered by so many other agencies. But one of the things that was said here today that really keeps sticking with me is that there were alternatives possibly suggested by independent parties that did not involve crossing the river at all. I share Commissioner Erskine's concern with the oyster productivity, and I just wonder if, it seems to me that as an agency that is tasked with protecting the bottoms of the Commonwealth, if there is an option that does not involve crossing the river at all, that's something that we should certainly look into.
Ben, you look like you have a response for an answer.
I don't have a response to that. I mean, we typically address the permit applications we receive. Certainly, this is a huge project, and there were alternatives as part of this package when we got it. Analysis. We typically don't try to re-engineer a project here. And I can limit my discussion to that. Unless Chip has any other management. Been an ongoing issue with this project of alternatives and whether they were properly vetted, fully vetted.
Ms. Alaska, I guess I would say that I'm sure that there's a number of us up here on the board wish this project looked otherwise than it does. However, this is indeed is the project that is before us that has cleared all so many other regulatory hurdles, and you've heard me say my reluctance to superimpose my will on all these other agencies' decisions, but Ben is right. If we have a project that, like a transportation project that impacts wetlands, we're not in the road design business. And at this point, we're not really, any of us up here, experts in power line construction. Unless some of you have a talent I don't know about. Mr. Erskine.
Well, I appreciate the comments, and I think I agree. We may wish there are alternatives, and it speaks to the testimony we heard about an environmental impact statement versus an environmental assessment that's done by a separate agency. I wish there was an environmental impact statement too. However, that's outside of our permitting agency and our jurisdiction in this. So I'm going to speak again for the latter part of the time of year restriction. And I agree with staff recommendation that it should be February 15th through June 15th. In fact, I would like to see it personally longer than June 15th. However, I understand those limitations with the applicant. But as much as we're protecting an anadromous species or doing the best we can with the available information we have for an anadromous species, in the early part of that time of year restriction, I go back to the fact that I still don't have somebody providing testimony that it will not impact potential oyster recruitment, and you're looking at a ending of that time of year restriction in the middle of when we would have potential oyster recruitment. So I could go along with this time of year restriction because it's the best available information we have at this time. However, I would caution the commission that we are maybe protecting the very early part of any oyster recruitment that may take place in probably the most productive river we have in the entire Commonwealth.
Can I have a question for AJ?
Sure, Mr. Neal. We know each other well enough.
If those time of year restrictions remained, would you be comfortable allowing two pylons at a time? The staff recommendation was for one pylon.
I wouldn't have an issue necessarily with one or two. I mean, I think there was an issue that if it's one at a time, they may not have the project completed by the 2020 right. Other permit from the Corps. So I would be okay with two if they could mobilize that. I think June 15th is really at the very end, very beginning of any oyster spawning event that they may see. Of course, that depends on temperature and salinity and other environmental issues as well. So.
Typically, in this stretch of the river, if it was a dredging project, we do typically recommend an extended time of year to protect shellfish. But as you heard the testimony of Vims, and these are pile driving. It's not that there's no effect, but it's not like a dredging project. It really, impacts the water quality. It really impacts spat set. And I think that's why Vims did not add an extension here, and we didn't add one as well.
And just to follow up, if I can,
Mr. Erskine,
that some of the other conditions in there would reduce that as well, as I understand, with sleeve around and bubble carton and those kind of things. So I agree. It's minimized to the best we can.
Mr. Packard.
I hear what Ms. Lusk is saying, and that was mine when I came to the commission meeting today. I thought to myself, there must be some better alternative that we can come up with in this time we live in. But one of the things we heard and testified today on the part of Dominion was the fact that this substation and the wires that come out of it are also important. It's not just the power that will be emanate, but the fact that this is as he mentioned, a backbone of the electrical grid that's part of a pretty significant portion of the Mid-Atlantic. So I think the alternatives may be in isolation possible, but given that there's this backbone that exists that we can't get around, I suspect from what I've heard in testimony today that the alternatives are pretty minimal, or they don't exist in any economically feasible fashion. And I certainly sympathize with the people who appreciate history and the beauty of the river. My people came here with Jamestown, with the Virginia Corporation, and fought in the Battle of Yorktown. I think our national history is important to all Americans, and I would, in many regards, like to say no to this project, but given the scope of influence and our charge within the laws of the state of Commonwealth, I really don't know how we could vote against the project, to be honest with you. I feel like the time of year restrictions I'd like to stay with. I do think we have that responsibility to our fisheries, and so I could see myself supporting staff recommendation.
Well, I'll note that the commission operates on motions, and the chair cannot make one. Mr. Zedrin.
I would make a motion we approve staff recommendation with the exception of number 6 and add that two towers to that instead of one.
Motion by Mr. Zedrin here. Does everybody understand the motion? Does anybody want to second the motion?
I'll second it.
Second by Mr. Neal. Is there a discussion on the motion?
So let me ask you that. One of the things that they pointed out was that the infrastructure, the barges and the cranes needed to do two at a time may be more than the river can accommodate. Is that something that would actually be useful? I heard that in testimony.
They were going to be set up for two towers. When we start talking about three, that was
okay.
I think they were going to be set up for two anyway, because they weren't going to drive at the same time.
All right. Thank you.
Well, we have a motion by Mr. Zedron and a second by Mr. Neal to approve the staff recommendation, except to allow the activity on two towers at a time. Is there additional discussion on this? I will call the question then. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any noes? The chair votes aye as well. The motion passes, and the project is approved with these permit conditions. I want to thank everybody who's come out today and spent your time and your passion and your energy here. The discussion has been robust. The discussion has been civil, and I thank you all. We will now adjourn for lunch for 45 minutes. We still have a long day today. When you're home this evening, watching the evening news, think of us, because we'll still be here. Lunchtime. We'll return at 1:45.